The following podcast of the STR radio program is made possible through the generous support of our listeners. You can support this podcast by going to str.org and making a donation today.
Welcome back, friends, to Stand for Reason. Really good to be with you today. My name is Jim Wallace. Jay Warner Wallace is usually the title I use when I come here and get a chance to host for Greg. So glad to be here again today on, I think, the third week, actually, where Greg has not been available. He's teaching again today. And as usual, he's a very hard worker, and the weekends don't seem to honor apologists. As a matter of fact, you probably do most of your work speaking to Christian groups on weekends. And, of course, that is exactly what he is doing today. I'm glad to be here in his absence. I'm from pleaseconvinceme.com and have been here a number of times in the past. Thanks so much to those of you who have gotten on our Facebook fan page and said something about today's visit here at Stand to Reason. Really glad to be ready to talk to you about the things that matter most, the things that Greg typically talks about here related to ethics, values, and religion. And let me get you online and get you in the queue so we can talk a little bit after my opening comments today. You can call toll-free at 1-800-227-5278. And locally here in Orange County. This first hour, we are broadcast just in our local footprint at 714-754-4150. So I think we'll have a chance to talk a little bit more after this opening comment. I want to get to just talking about the nature of the evidence that you and I refer to, that you and I trust, as we examine the claims of Christianity. Now, I, for a living, work as a detective, and I try to give you a perspective that will help you to examine evidence, especially related to things that are typically are sometimes thought of as being oblivious or impervious to inspection by way of evidence. Most people are in our worldview, people are sitting next to us in church, people who would call themselves Christians and are following Christ, have devoted themselves to Christ and trust Christ for their salvation, may not think of Christianity as a view that could be examined with evidence. Now, I work cold cases. These are events in the distant past for which there are no living eyewitnesses and no forensic evidence. And we have to assemble a case, usually largely circumstantial, in order to make the case against a particular suspect that we believe committed a crime. And so as a result of that, we get very familiar with the use of circumstantial evidence in the courtroom. Now, that being the case, We understand, I think, in a way that's maybe unique to the profession, just how powerful circumstantial evidence can be. Now, my cases are much like examining the Christian worldview, an event 2,000 years ago for which there are no living eyewitnesses and little or no, no forensic evidence, really. So we've got to make a case for what happened in the distant past, although it's not a murder that occurred 30 years ago. It's an event that occurred 2,000 years ago, and we're going to use a lot of the same tool set that we would use if we were doing cold cases. And some of our cases get national attention, and we had a couple this year that were featured on Dateline. One was featured a couple of weeks ago. And I noticed afterwards the case was called Deadly Triangle. And afterwards on the Dateline page, on the Dateline Facebook page, I noticed a number of people loved it and said things that they understood, obviously how the evidence came together. But many people looked at the case and said, you know, I don't know how it is that these folks even could convict this poor guy. I mean, it didn't seem like there was any hard evidence. All they had was circumstantial evidence. And that sentence is very telling. All they had was circumstantial evidence. In essence, they're saying they didn't have any real evidence. They just had that lousy junk stuff that really doesn't amount to anything. It doesn't really count. And so I look at those kinds of comments and I think, well, gosh, you know, here's the problem you have with trying to do a case that took 2 years to put together. And you're doing that case in 50 minutes, 45 minutes or so. And as you're working hard to put the case together in a way that makes sense to people who are watching it, you can only mention so much. And it just so happens that the nature of circumstantial evidence is such that we need a very robust telling of the narrative. We need to see everything and have everything on the table before we can step off and say, yeah, I think the case has been made. Let me explain to you the nature of circumstantial evidence related to direct evidence. These are the two differences you have. All evidence can be broken largely into these two categories. Direct evidence, and what's known as indirect or circumstantial evidence. Direct evidence, of course, are those things that testify or relate directly to the claim you're trying to prove. And typically when this is being described to jurors in a trial setting, judges will take the time to say, hey, let me give you an example of this. Let me help you to see it by way of example. And they will say something like the analogy of if it's raining outside. As a matter of fact, there's an instruction that is written into the California Criminal Code. That is, let's quote it for you. And when jurors are being instructed related to direct evidence, this is what judges typically say. They'll say, quote, if a witness testifies that he saw it was raining outside the courthouse before he came into the courthouse, that testimony is direct evidence that it was raining. So what you have is an eyewitness who would testify directly to the thing it is you're examining. Was it raining outside? And the evidence would be the testimony of a witness who said, yes, in fact, it was. But what if you didn't have that? Let me just stay with this analogy and give you a couple other pieces of evidence to kind of show you how the circumstantial case might be made. What if you just saw that somebody came in from outside and the door opened and they came in and they were just drenched, soaking wet? And they, you know, brushed off this water and shook their clothes slightly and then sat down to get ready to work. Well, this is a piece of evidence. Now, does it make the case that it's raining outside? No, but not really. I mean, it could be a number of things, right, that could cause somebody to be wet. He might be wet because, you know, he walked through a sprinkler. Somebody drove by and splashed water out of the gutter on him. Who knows why he's wet, right? Doesn't mean it's necessarily raining. That one piece in and of itself, a piece of indirect evidence, a piece of circumstantial evidence, does not make the case, do you think? I don't think it does. Let's say, on the other hand, you added to that another piece. Let's say you added that you just then later saw somebody get up, walk to the door from inside, open the door and poke their head out, and then kind of pull themselves back in, walk back over to their briefcase, get their umbrella, open their umbrella, and walk outside. Now, if you put those two pieces together, one who comes in drenched, soaking wet, and one who pokes his head out and then comes back in and gets an umbrella before he ventures out into the outside, you, I think, have a better case from two pieces of circumstantial evidence that it is, in fact, raining outside. Let me add another piece. Let's say that you, a few seconds later, see a third person come in. He's wet also, but he's carrying an umbrella, and he shakes off the umbrella and closes it and puts it away and sits down. Now you have a piece of evidence. He's also wet from some form of water, but clearly he was carrying an umbrella when he came in. Do you see how the more pieces of circumstantial evidence we have, the more and more reasonable it is that it's raining outside? And of course, if I could do this 20 times and provide 20 pieces of evidence that can best be explained by the fact that it's raining outside, then the case becomes more and more overwhelming that in fact it is raining outside. And although you don't have a single person who's standing on the stand or sitting on the stand and telling you that it's raining, from those pieces of circumstantial evidence, the most reasonable conclusion is that it is raining. This is the power of circumstantial evidence. And cases that are made with circumstantial evidence are usually quite deep. There are a number of pieces of evidence that are used to make the case. The more pieces you have, the stronger the case is. And you need to have more pieces when you're dealing with circumstantial evidence, because any one of these in isolation might be explained by a defense attorney whose job it is to take every one and try to knock it to the ground, try to get rid of the individual pieces. He knows as well, or she knows as well as I do, that the case, if it has 30 pieces of evidence, is much stronger than if it has three. So the idea is to try to limit it and winnow it down to those three pieces he can easily describe in some other way. One more thing. Did you notice how when we're doing circumstantial cases, we're looking for the most reasonable explanation? Are there always going to be other possible explanations? Yes. But possible doesn't matter in these kinds of cases. It's only what is reasonable. Because honestly, anything is possible. We talked about it, I think, before here on Stand to Reason. I have, at least, I think, and I think I've talked about it a number of times on my own show at Please Convince Me. And I can tell you that reasonable and possible are the dilemma that most of us have when examining evidence. It's true that anything could be possible. You could be imagining you're hearing me right now, when in fact this is a large dream that's been caused by aliens who kidnapped both of us, and we're all imagining the same thing under some form of alien hypnosis. Is that possible? Okay, yeah, anything's possible. Is it reasonable? In court, jurors are told that what's possible is not as important as what's reasonable. As a matter of fact, when you're speculating about things that you think are possible without an evidential foundation, that is called speculation, and it's not to occur in a jury room. We're to focus on what's reasonable. Now, I bring all this up, of course, because what we do as Christian case makers, as people who have made two decisions, a decision to surrender our lives to Christ, to trust Christ for our salvation, and a second decision to defend what it is we believe, those of us who would call ourselves two-decision Christians, we're out here in the marketplace of ideas trying to make a case for what we believe, trying to defend the truth of the Christian worldview. And when we do that, we're going to be making evidential cases that are circumstantial. It's just the nature of looking at an event in the distant past. You're not going to have a living eyewitness who can testify to this. I can make a very good circumstantial case, I believe, for the validity and reliability of the Gospels as eyewitness testimony. But that's another idea altogether. I'm going to have to make a circumstantial case for their reliability, aren't I? And I'm not going to be able to have somebody walk in and say, well, you know, I was there when Mark wrote that, so I can testify that Mark is actually the author. I have to make a circumstantial case for the reliability of Mark's Gospel. And in fact, what we find ourselves doing as Christian casemakers is repeatedly making circumstantial cases for what it is we believe. So we better understand the value of circumstantial evidence and also be able to explain to people that circumstantial evidence is every bit as valid in a courtroom as direct evidence. In some ways, I would argue that it's actually more trustworthy. Here's why I say that. You and I both know that eyewitnesses can lie. And as a matter of fact, aren't our skeptical friends always accusing the gospel writers of doing just that? Well, as we build a slow circumstantial case built on a number of pieces of evidence, those pieces cannot lie to us. We get, in fact, the ability and the right to infer from what the evidence should suggest. In other words, there's no malice in circumstantial evidence, even if there might be malice on the part of any individual eyewitness. The circumstantial evidence is rather benign. It is what it is. We get to assess it and infer from it what we will. It can't lie to us intentionally in order to deceive us. It simply presents itself, and then we have to make a case from what is presented. Now, why is that important to us as Christian case makers? Well, largely because we have a very robust, very deep circumstantial case that we can make for any number of things. If, as an atheist for 35 years, the first thing I need to is somebody to present the case for God's existence. Now, you know as well as I do that there are times when you might have your favorite line of evidence, your favorite form of evidence for God's existence. You're somebody who maybe loves the axiological argument. You love to argue for God's existence from the existence of moral truth. And maybe this is the thing you feel most comfortable with, but I'm sure you've found yourself in a situation where this one piece of evidence does not seem compelling to the person you're talking to. Just as the one piece of evidence that somebody comes in and is wet, let's say, is not compelling in and of itself that it's raining outside. It could be some other explanation for this. It's when I look at all the other elements in unison with that, the cumulative circumstantial case, that's when I see it as compelling. So for me, I look at the arguments for God's existence, and I look at the entire robust and deep circumstantial case, the case from the fine-tuning evidence we see in the universe, the case from design evidence that I do believe we see in biological systems, the case from moral evidence that we see in what we now call the axiological argument, or the causal evidence that we might see in the cosmological argument. And I think you can add to that several other lines of evidence from the ontological argument, the transcendental argument, the argument from aesthetic experience or religious experience. All of these arguments are robust and deep. Here's the dilemma I think you and I face as Christian casemakers. If I was going to make a case for the fact that it's raining outside and make that case in a persuasive way so that jurors would have no problem saying, yes, we agree that it's raining outside, I would have to bring in many strands of evidence, many lines of evidence, because these are all circumstantial. If I have no eyewitness who can simply tell me it's raining outside. This is the dilemma I think I have as a casemaker. I have to have a setting and the ability to present the robust, complete, cumulative, circumstantial case, because I know that any one piece may not be compelling for people. So I typically now have learned that I don't want to sit in a jury and try a case that's important to me that I've been working on for 2 years without first making sure the jury understands the nature and power of circumstantial evidence. We've got to take time to teach them about circumstantial evidence before we begin. And then I also want to make sure that I present the fullest and most robust case I can in front of the jury. And this is what I think happens to us as apologists as well. We want to do two things. Make sure the people I'm talking to understand the nature and validity and value and power of circumstantial evidence, number one. And then two, hopefully have the ability to at least touch upon the deep cumulative case that I think exists for a number of things, for God's existence, for the reliability of the scriptures, for the truth of the resurrection. All of these case points I think can be made by a robust circumstantial evidential case. I think that's really the challenge we face as Christian case makers. But it's not beyond our ability to do that. And I think sometimes we'll focus on one piece of evidence at the risk of losing people because they don't understand the depth and the complete nature of the case for Christianity. Well, I'm looking forward to talking to you about this case. There's lots to talk about this weekend. So much is happening in the news. So much has happened since the first of the year. This is our first full week in 2012, right? And I'm looking forward to talking to you about some of those things. But if you've got questions about the nature of evidence, about the reliability of the scriptures, I'd love to dive into that with you. Or anything that might come to mind related to ethics, values, and religion. Please give me a call, toll-free, 1-800-227-5278, and locally here at 714-754-4150. We'll come back after this break right here at Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg Kokel here, inviting you to a conference you won't soon forget. The location? The Eastern Caribbean. Join us as we set sail March 17, 2012, from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for 8 days aboard Holland America's MS Eurodam for an unforgettable trip to Grand Turks and Caicos Islands, San Juan, Puerto Rico, St. Thomas and the Virgin Islands, and Half Moon Cay in the Bahamas. I'll be joined by Stand to Reason Student Impact Director Brett Kunkel and STR speaker and trainer Alan Schliemann for a lineup of conference sessions that will stimulate your thinking and equip you with practical skills. Everything about this trip is being planned with your enjoyment and enrichment in mind. And this year we're planning some special youth sessions led by Brett, so plan on bringing the family and enjoying great times of fellowship and spiritual deepening together. Not only will you be challenged with stimulating presentations, you'll have a chance to ask questions in open forum discussions and enjoy the interaction and fellowship with both our speakers and your fellow passengers on deck, sharing great meals together and ashore as we enjoy the splendor of the Eastern Caribbean's beautiful resort ports. So save the dates and contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours. That's 800-247-1899. They're assisting Stand to Reason with their trip, and their skilled staff is committed to answering all your questions and helping to make this a memorable experience. You can also visit our website at str.org for all the information. I hope to see you there in the Caribbean with Stand to Reason.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? STR.org is a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for. Before you turn to Google, log on to STR.org, and you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse the range of topics, from our radio archives to advanced online training to our blog. You'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from STR.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ and the tactics that will help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. Your visit to STR.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you take a stand for the truth. So visit today. That's STR.org.
So glad to be back with you here today. Jim Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel. I should say Jay Warner. I got to remember to say Jay Warner Wallace. It's just so hard. There's lots of Jim Wallaces out there, and it happens to be a very popular and well-known Jim Wallace from Sojourners. That is not me. I am Jay Warner Wallace from Please Convince Me. Glad to be here sitting in for Greg, talking about ethics, values, and religion, and really trying to carry on this tradition that Greg has been so influential in my own life, helping me to be a clear-thinking Christian. And I want to help you do the same thing as well. So I've got the first call we'll take in today is going to be Lou from Tarzana, California, talking a little bit about evidence. Hang on a second here. Lou, I think I have you. Are you on the line?
Yes, hi, Jim. I wanted to point out something to you that an attorney once pointed out to me regarding direct evidence. And he said, in criminal cases, the best evidence that can be presented is eyewitness testimony with corroboration, meaning two witnesses or more. And the case he pointed out to me was the O.J. Simpson trial. He said with all the evidence they had in that trial, indirect and direct, they couldn't get a conviction. But if they had had two eyewitnesses to that murder, he said there's no question that there would have been a conviction.
You make a good point. A good point about eyewitness testimony. This is one of the things that I often will discuss because a lot of recently has been done. And I get emails sent to me all the time, Lou, where people will write and say, more and more studies have been done about the eyewitness reliability over time. And, oh, my gosh, we discovered that lots of folks in these kinds of testing they'll do cannot be trusted over time. So the idea that eyewitness testimony would in the past be a high level, a high form of direct evidence has come under challenge by people who would say, hey, you can't even trust eyewitnesses over the course of a year. They forget so much. And so you're absolutely right. I would never suggest that we ought to take eyewitness testimony blindly. All the time, this is one of the things I talk about a lot, is we have to evaluate eyewitnesses.
Right, but we're talking about corroborating eyewitness testimony. That means two or more witnesses.
Well, it means a couple of things. Okay. Definitely a second witness can help corroborate you. There's no doubt about it. But other forms of evidence can also help to corroborate a witness. So let me give you an example. If I said to you that I saw him, the robber in a bank robbery, come over and lean across the counter and talk to a bank teller and actually reached over and he touched the teller's drawer that had money in it. And I later find that, sure enough, I've got a palm print on the counter and a fingerprint on the drawer. I now have corroboration for the eyewitness testimony that was offered me by the one eyewitness. So a corroboration can come in many forms. Sometimes it's two, but you could also imagine, is it possible that two people might conspire together to lie to me about an event? It's possible. So I'm looking for some form of corroboration. I certainly will take another eyewitness. But if I don't have that, I'd be happy to have some other form of evidence, a fingerprint, some piece of forensic evidence, DNA, something that would help to corroborate what this eyewitness has told me. Now, let me tell you why I even bring that up, Lou, okay? I bring it up because as a Christian casemaker, how many times, and I'm not sure if Lou, you are in fact a Christian, are you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So how many times have you been making a case for, let's say, the eyewitness testimony of Matthew? And you'll get this typical response, well, I don't trust any of the gospel writers. They worked together to form this vast conspiracy. They had a reason to do this. And so the corroboration of Luke, for example, or the corroboration, not say Luke, let's go John. John's eyewitness corroboration of Matthew doesn't really work for me because I don't think either one of them is telling me the truth. Blah, blah, blah. So I'm looking now for things that are outside the eyewitness account that might corroborate what's being said inside the eyewitness account. And I'm also looking for internal consistency in the eyewitness account. And I think these are different forms and lines of evidence I can use to corroborate what Matthew said. Does that make sense?
It does. I wonder why Jesus chose 12 eyewitnesses to his ministry.
Well, I also look at it this way. He did more than that. He said, hey, if you don't trust what I'm telling you, at least trust the evidence of these miracles that I'm presenting in front of you. So he's
right.
Giving us more than just the testimony. Even to those people who were in that first range of eyewitnesses who did not believe, he gave evidence that his words were actually true. So I think we can look at things, for example, like archaeological corroboration, first century literature that helps us to understand the languages being used by the gospel writers, internal consistency of the documents themselves. I do think we can look at these things and say, hey, these are the things we would use. And, of course, we've got to remember, Lou, that you know as well as I do, events that occur in the last 5 years, and we're now investigating these and going to trial with these events, are very different than events that occur in the ancient past or even 100 years ago historically. We have to understand the limits of doing history, and there's only so much we can do. But within that, we would say, is this a reliable event in history, as reliable as other events in history? And if at least we do that kind of work, I think we're on the right track. Let me just say one more thing, though, also about the O.J. case, and without making a statement about how I felt about the trial itself. Regardless of how you or I might feel about the outcome of that trial, one thing is certain, It's very important for us to know up front if the people we're communicating with are predisposed to be open to the evidence. Now, I'm not even sure that was the case or wasn't the case in OJ or in other big trials like Casey Anthony or any of these big trials that have occurred in the last 15 years. But one thing I know for sure, we take time when we select juries. And it's not as though we just take the first 12 people who walk through the door. Both sides, prosecution and defense, get to take their time asking questions of the jurors to at least make sure they don't hold a presupposition which would prevent them from seeing anything in an unbiased way. So we know there are many reasons why somebody might reject a truth claim. Either they don't think there's enough evidence for it, they have an emotional bias against it, or they have a volitional bias against it, right? We don't want to bend their knee to it. We have to take some time that, hey, even if we do all this hard work and we present all the evidence accurately, many people may look at it and say, it doesn't move me because they've got some other reason not to be moved that's not evidential. So I hope that helps a little bit.
There's also, a jurist by the name of Simon Greenleaf wrote an excellent review in a series of law review books called The Four Gospels from a Lawyer's Standpoint.
Yes.
And he presented evidence of the gospels that could be presented in court, and I thought that was excellently done.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I know that Greg has talked about that quite a bit here on the show. I'm looking at my collection here. By the way, for those of you who have maybe not tapped into the beautiful wonder of Kindle, I just love, or any of the e-books out there. For me, it's been a great way to organize my book collection as well, and I take it with me everywhere I go. And one of the books that I look at a lot also is The Evidence of the Evangelists by Simon Greenleaf. There's a couple of books that are out there that can be resource this way, looking at the testimony of the four Gospels and examining them evidentially from a perspective of a legal. This is one of the things that I'm trying to do as well. I just finished a manuscript that I sent to the publisher last month, and my hope is when it comes out, you'll see what the Gospels, how I view the Gospels, the way that, what I would be asking of the Gospel writers if I was looking at them as eyewitnesses and knew that later I'm going to have to put these folks up in front of a jury and they're going to have to be examined in a way for their reliability. What are the kind of areas that I'm looking at? What are the areas that are important to me? And do the Gospel writers measure up in those areas? So I think it's fair for us to think about how eyewitnesses are examined. How do we know if they're reliable? And then say, hey, are these Gospel writers, as well as we can tell from history, as much as we know about any ancient writer, do these four Gospel writers measure up? And I think that's a fair assessment for us to do. Here's the thing I think is different than most, and I'll read an article here in a second when I let you go, Lou, and just if you'll get back on the air and listen to as I read it, is there's a sense that that people who are skeptics think that our worldview is a series of parables, just a series of statements about the nature of life, the nature of God, and therefore it's simply a matter of trust on our part, a matter of blind faith on our part, whether we believe these parables or we believe these proverbs to be true. Well, instead, the Christian worldview is an event rooted in history that can be tested. If there's a falsifiable nature to Christianity that separates it from other religious worldviews. Not all religious, other religious worldviews are also rooted in history. But the great thing about an event that's rooted in the past is we can examine it in the same way we can examine a crime scene that's also rooted in the past. So I think there are some tool sets we can transfer from doing investigations, cold case investigations, into this examination of the Christian worldview. Hope that helps a little bit, Lou, as you kind of go forward with it.
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks so much, Lou. I'll talk to you soon.
Right.
Bye-bye. Now, let me just, before we go any further, read an article that I brought with me, because I thought it was something that was quite provocative. I was in the Huffington Post on December 28th. Was posted by Paul Pardi, P-A-R-D-I. You can shoot over to Huffington Post. It's still posted there today. And the reason why I'm bringing it up is because I think it does relate a little bit to what Lou was talking about. Let me just read it to you. The title of the post is Why Faith Claims Should Be Corrected, a Professor's Argument. So I'll read this rather short article from Paul Pardi. Just bear with me. You'll see where he's getting at. Here he writes, Professor Peter Boghossian of Portland State University believes that when a student makes a faith claim in a classroom, it's the professor's duty to tell them they're wrong. Because faith claims are not empirical or testable, professors should stop treating such claims with kid gloves and start correcting the students who make them. He made this argument in a short article for the journal Inside Higher Ed and then gave a subsequent talk where he argued that faith is a kind of cognitive sickness that should not be given equal time in the classroom. Claims like these are grabbing the attention of atheists and theists alike because they have the potential to affect the way we think about faith. Again, this is Paul Pardee's article in the Huffington Post. Let me continue. The article has garnered a lot of attention, including approvingly that of Sam Harris, and disapprovingly of Wikipedia co-founder Larry Sanger, who lambasted the professor for his views. Because of the interest in this topic, I sat down – this is Paul Pardee speaking – I sat down with Professor Boghossian to dig into his claims a bit more deeply. His ideas are important ones that in that they capture what I think a lot of people are discussing when it comes to faith in the public square. Many are questioning whether faith claims are appropriate in a modern, scientifically literate classroom, and for that matter, society. Professor Boghossian clearly thinks they aren't and argues that professors should have the courage to say so. At the heart of Boghossian's argument is the idea that students should leave a classroom more informed about the world than when they entered it. And since faith claims aren't publicly testable, students who make them shouldn't be given a seat at the adult table. Boghossian makes the distinction between a private belief that impacts only the person believing it, like the belief that peanut butter tastes good, and public claims that are supposed to have implications for the rest of us, like the claim that God disapproves of contraception. Beliefs about God and his activity are private beliefs that students are welcome to hold, but these beliefs should not be a part of the educational conversation. If a student makes a public argument that's based on a private belief, professors should call these students out and help correct their thinking. Again, we're reading from Paul Pardee's article, Why Faith Claims Should Be Corrected, in the Huffington Post on 12/28. Let me continue. Boghossian is clear that the crux issue is not about the claims themselves. Rather, he focuses on addressing the processes one uses to get to those claims. Professors must, quote, meaningfully discuss these issues and talk about the process of one uses and the fact that certain processes are unreliable to lead one to the truth, faith being one of those processes, and have educators call people out on, quite frankly, delusion, unquote. For example, flipping coins or sacrificing goats is not a reliable process for predicting the weather. Scientific processes that test and correct hypotheses are. Faith claims, according to Boghossian, are grounded on processes much more like flipping coins than evidence-based research. If a student makes a claim not based on evidence and argument, why should such a claim have any authority in a classroom? In his article, Boghossian notes that a student wrote on a final exam that despite what she learned in the classroom, her belief in God was, quote, absolute, unquote, and no amount of philosophy would ever change that. The processes that led the student to such unequivocal belief are not only faulty but dangerous, says Boghossian, and the professors would be remiss if they let students leave their classroom believing that such processes are reliable. These issues have much wider cultural implications. This is, again, Paul Pardee writing. Should faith claims have any authority in politics, for example? According to a recent Gallup poll, more than 90% of Americans claim to believe in some higher power. Shouldn't this belief have an impact on how we think about governance? Boghossian says no, because this is not a belief that could even possibly be evaluated for truth. The fact that the majority believes it doesn't mean it has merit. He makes a comparison to beliefs about slavery in the past. Mass delusion is still delusion. What role should faith play, if any, in the way we think about the conversation in the classroom or in ordered society? According to Boghossian, it should be relegated to personal preferences like a taste for peanut butter or what to do in one's free time. Faith claims should not be given any educational or social authority. And in case you missed it, that's a public truth claim and one that should and will be discussed broadly and deeply as the role of faith continues to evolve. That's the article from Paul Pardee, written in the Huffington Post last month, about 2 weeks ago. Now, of course, the last statement that Pardee makes when talking about Boghossian's claim is an accurate one. He's making a claim that in and of itself, that this claim about how we ought to know things, how we ought to consider things, is not a claim that can be tested in the way that he would expect our claims to be tested. So his very theory eats itself. It's a cannibal, or as Greg often says here, it commits suicide as an idea. But I think it's interesting because I would agree with one small piece of Boghossian's argument, and that is that if we are accepting things on the basis of blind faith, we have committed a mistake, I believe, because we are not then able to defend ourselves even against this article and articles like this written by Paul Pardee or the position taken by Peter Boghossian. The fact of the matter is that we don't, I mean, if you've been listening to this show very long, and I've been listening to this show since really the moment I became a Christian, I can tell you that none of us would say this is the manner in which we assess Christianity, is it? Yet isn't it interesting that the world around us can still point to Christians and argue that this is the way that we accept the truth claims of Christianity, we accept them on the basis of faith, when you and I both know, as people who listen to this show for a period of time, that's the last thing. I mean, especially if you've worked with folks, maybe in other faith groups, where I've worked with lots of LDS friends, and I have lots of LDS family, and who would never take an evidential approach to their faith. I've yet to meet anyone in my family who is a Mormon who has taken an evidential approach to their faith. And so, of course, I would also argue that if you don't take an evidential approach to your faith, you might find yourself in a position of error. You and I have a duty, I think, to look at the witnesses, to look at the eyewitnesses, and to evaluate them in a way that Lou has described and that has been written about by Simon Greenleaf and others, and that I hope to also contribute to that conversation. Okay, how are we doing on time? Should we take a break now, or should we take another call? Let's take a break right now. We'll come back and take your calls. We've got somebody online right now waiting to, and Brian will get to you in just 1 minute. In addition to that, if you want to join the conversation, I'm at 1-800-227-5278 or locally at 714-754-4150. Of course. Looking forward to talking to you right here at Stand to Reason.
We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material, too, by using the brand-new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org or call 1-800-2-REASON.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel, and boy, am I excited to offer you my new book, Tactics. It's a book that I wrote to help you discuss your Christian convictions with non-Christians, and it outlines specific steps to follow that you can take that will help those conversations be less intimidating and more effective. And we've seen a tremendous response to this book, and many people have already told me how much it will help them. And I hope it will help you too. To get a copy for yourself or as a gift, simply visit tacticsbook.com. It's my aim to help you make a difference for the kingdom with this book. To order your copy, simply visit tacticsbook.com.
Again, Stand to Reason Radio. Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel. Basic training for your mind. That's what we're trying to do here. And of course, it doesn't mean that my mind is completely trained up. Of course, if you've listened very long, you probably already know that. But the point is, I'd love to be able to kind of sharpen each other as we discuss the issues together and cause each other to think a little bit. My whole goal here is, especially when I co-host or I come in and guest host for Greg, is to just be able to advance the conversation a little bit with you as I think through the issues for myself as well. In the end, what I don't want to be is somebody who takes any of these views for granted, either views that establish the truth of Christianity or views that help us think about how we ought to see the world around us as Christians. And so in that second regard, I think we've got a call here from Brian, which we'll take, that might help us to think about the world around us. Hey, Brian, how are you? Do I have you on the line, Brian? Maybe we lost him. Hey, we're going to get him back here. So we've got Brian calling in about an issue related to same-sex marriage. And I'm letting Melinda we may have lost him. We'll come back to him in a second. But that is one of the things I think that our duty is to look at the world around us and see how does our worldview comport. Now, Brian, are you on the line now?
I can hear you.
Oh, that's awesome. So, see, I thought I lost you there, and I didn't lose you. So, I hate having those embarrassing moments on the radio. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the issue of same-sex marriage. You had a question about it.
Yeah, so I am in Los Angeles. I work in Hollywood. So I am exposed to a lot of ideas regarding this, and I talk about it a lot, and I hear a lot of opinions. And it's a hot issue, and it's also a very sensitive one. We can talk about our faith and our different views on so many different things, but when we get into same-sex couples and marriage and even adoption, things like that, it's always kind of a heated discussion. And so I've been looking for good answers and good ways to express my point of view and to be fair and open-minded for some time now. And it was around the time that we were voting on Prop 8 that Greg Kokel was giving a lecture that my wife and I went to go listen to. And coming away from that, he said something that the more I've thought about, I've kind of had an issue with, and I wanted to see what you think.
Okay.
Greg first started, at least with his lecture, saying we all agree that at least the Bible says that homosexuality is wrong, just so we could kind of make sure we're on the same page. So he made a case for that. And then as he went further along, his conclusion was, okay, we're not really talking about rights here because same-sex couples have the same rights as heterosexual couples. It's more about respect and that they're trying to just be more respected in the world. And so because of civil unions, they have the same rights is what he was getting at.
Right.
But then he also said, I'm not going to fight over just a word. And that word being marriage. So now I'm thinking, well, then which one is it? Is it the same rights? Are they actually fighting for rights, or do they have the exact same rights? And if they have the exact same rights, then it kind of looks to me like we are just fighting over a word.
No, I understand. There's so much depth here. You always be very careful that when you answer a question that I think is this important to you and I, both as you know, I was 35 years as an atheist, and I had a very different view of many social issues than I do today. And I held that view, and I think I would have argued in much of the same way that now I find myself having to think a little more clearly about some of the statements I made for many years. And so, like you, these are important issues. I'm always a little bit cautious because I know that it's very easy to soundbite one aspect of our total response here and move on that soundbite rather than to think of the entire thing as a very well-woven fabric of ideas that all come together. Again, it's kind of like a circumstantial case in which the power of the case is in its cumulative nature. So let me just do my best to kind of give you my view related to this idea. This is kind of the argument you're hearing, and is it unjust for us to deny same-sex couples a right, marriage, that is afforded to others? So in essence, we're saying that marriage is a right that we should afford them if we're going to afford it to anybody. Would you agree? That's kind of the crux of the argument?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I think one of the things I do, and I think this is where Greg and I would agree, is that I've got to examine marriage and ask myself, is this a right or a privilege?
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a privilege, then it moves it into a different category.
Okay.
And so I would kind of argue that while lots of individuals may have a right to engage in an emotional or a physical relationship with another consenting adult, you know, this happens, that's a little bit different than a licensed, authorized, and publicly approved marriage. And I would see it more as a privilege like other licensed privileges that the culture gives. Now, this is, I think, you know, if it's a right, it's very different than if it's a governmentally granted privilege. That's the first kind of observation I would make. In other words, people have the right to engage in a loving relationship, right, with another consenting adult. But this is very different than whether or not we should license this as a privilege, license this as the same way we might. Do you see what I'm saying? So I would agree with Greg that there are you see that people who are the same sex are already engaged in relationships. Many states have already afforded these relationships the same benefits that you would have in a marriage, of being able to see your loved one during times of sickness, of disposing of property, these kinds of things we always talk about. These are the kinds of kind of legal rights we say. And these things already exist, really, in the vast majority of cases. So what do we really, what are they really, what's the push here for? Is it really for the rights that come along with marriage, or is it for something else that comes along with the word marriage that we're trying to do here, we're trying to advance here? And this is the thing that I always come back to. And I this, Brian, this is kind of the thing that always ends up being my sticking point. It's really an issue of what isn't the best. Why do governments even get involved in this question at all to begin with? Why do they even care who gets married? Isn't it really more concern about the next generation of citizens? And so I'm always looking at probably the more controversial position to take, which is, what is in the best interest of the next generation of citizens? What's in the best interest of kids?
Yeah.
And as I look at it, and all the research that I'm seeing, and lots of folks recently have posted the research on one side or the other, so we can, that's one of those things, we look at all the evidence and kind of weigh it for ourselves. But the evidence that I see, both anecdotally and in my own life, working in gang details, working in other details where I have kids who are, we would say are problem kids or kids who are involved in the criminal justice system, what I see over and over again is when you've got an intact family where mom and dad are both present, you see the lowest rates of male incarceration. You see the lowest rate of teenage pregnancy. You see all the things that we are concerned about our young people engaging in are at their lowest when you have traditional family units. Now, I think that's a case that I would want to make. Is that true, number one? And if it is true, is it the duty of our society to somehow benefit that kind of relationship, because we're concerned not about whether you're happy in your marriage, whether you're happy in your relationship. I'm concerned about the raising of the next generation of citizens. And so yeah. this is what motivates me anyway. Go ahead, please.
With that thought, I think that's good, and I've brought that up to some people in the past, but then what seems to come back is the argument that's like, well, sure, statistics are going to show that, you know, by and large, kids are going to come out better if they have both mom and dad there. But that's because if mom and dad aren't there, then what that usually means is that it's just mom, or maybe in some cases just dad. But it's not dad and dad, or mom and mom. So it's not fair. And then they also say, like, so are you suggesting that mom and mom are somehow corrupted or insufficient? So I guess the argument that they're saying is two is better than one, but it doesn't matter what two is.
Yeah, that's where I would say that I don't believe that the evidence actually supports that. Let me just point you up to a place where I really had a hard time. I wanted to be able to say that my view on this issue was, number one, directed first and foremost by my biblical worldview. So I spent some time writing about whether or not what is it that God actually says about same-sex marriage. And I posted an article on Please Convince Me. It's in the Hot Topics section on that. But I also posted a very long article on should government legalize same-sex marriage, because it was a question that I needed answered for myself. And that article is based purely on what I discovered in the research related to the benefits to the welfare of kids going forward. As a matter of fact, I created a kid paradigm, KIDS. Take a look at it online. It's just called Should Government Legalize Same-Sex Marriage? It's at Please Convince Me in the Hot Topics section. You'll also see an article there called Responding to Those Who Support Same-Sex Marriage. And this issue of whether or not this is a right or a privilege, does that make a difference? Is it just to deny some people this label of marriage? All of those questions are answered in really great detail on that second article, Responding to Those Who Support Same-Sex Marriage. I know that Greg has written a ton about this at STR as well. I know you can Google through that at the STR website. But I know that for me, it's going to come back down to, I do believe there's a difference. Let me just also say this. You know, this idea that two guys can raise daughters as well as a guy and a mom and a husband, or that two women can raise a son as well as a woman and a man. I think that, you know, in principle, the fear we have as Christians is if we say that's not true, that somehow we are denigrating either the women in a two lesbian relationship, or the one of the men in a two male homosexual relationship, that somehow we're being unkind to the participants in those relationships by saying that they're not quite equipped to do what we think is necessary to raise kids. I can tell you this. For a lot of years, I would work nothing but robbers. And I would take guys to jail all the time, young men in their late teens, early 20s. And some of these guys were really icy, cold folks, and some of these kids were just misguided. And you could see they were still in the early stages of being misguided. And first thing I would do was get on the phone with their parents. I don't care if they were 25 or 30. I would still get on the phone with parents. This is, I wanted to know, you know, just on an anecdotal basis, my own little informal research project, what's going on. I can't tell you the number of times I had a mom tell me that she was so lost because she'd done everything she could with her son. I mean, he's been raised in the church. I took him to church every Sunday. He knows right from wrong. He was a good kid growing up. And then go through this litany of things that she did in order to keep her kids off the streets. And I would always ask, what about Dad? What's Dad's involvement? Well, you know, he did, and invariably, over and over again, it was the same message. Lack of Dad. Lack of Dad because Dad's a workaholic, never home. Lack of Dad because Dad's a first-generation American, never even learned to speak the English language, is not paying attention to his son because he's working 80 hours a week. Lack of Dad because he's an alcoholic and never even awake. Lack of Dad because he's incarcerated. Lack of Dad because he left us when the junior was two. Whatever the reason was, it was lack of Dad that was a compelling contributor to where the son ended up years later. You know, in the end, I remember working gangs years ago, and the movie Boys in the Hood came out. And my partner was working gangs with me. He said, you got to see this movie. Because you'll see a line in the movie. And I forgot the star who stars as the dad in this. He tells his son that he will not, he cannot. In order to learn to be a man, you have to have a man teach a young boy how to be a man. And he points to his son across the street. That those kids across the street, they don't have somebody to teach them what it is to be a man. And that to me was so powerful as a dad who had two sons at that time and is working on my tail off and probably spending way too much time at work. It was very powerful for me to say, wow, you know, there is some truth to my involvement as dad in this relationship. And I've always kind of held on to that. And anecdotally, that's the thing that I thought really kind of drove my thinking a little bit, if I'm honest with you, about why I think two-parent households are probably going to produce, have the best opportunity to produce. Now, let me just say one thing before I let you go. I'm sorry, we're going to come up on the break here in a few minutes, but I've got one more call holding here. But let me just say that one of the concerns I have is that when we talk about the issue of marriage and whether or not both parties are necessary in marriage, I'm always wanting to be very careful not to to sound like I'm belittling or denigrating the ability of the partners involved in this marriage. And I'm very careful not to step off in that direction. But in the end, I think there's a case that can be made from the scientific data that – and one last thing too. I'm always careful also to say that, hey, there's lots of opposite-sex marriages that are a mess. And I was raised in a broken home. My parents divorced when I was three. I didn't even have Dad around. I mean, my mom did a good job. Is it possible to overcome the long odds in a broken situation? Of course it is. But is this the ideal that I would want to promote as a society? No, it's not. So I'm always careful to say, look, I understand, because the first thing I hear from these folks is, well, look, how about these marriages where Dad's beating on Mom all the time? Well, of course, that's not a good situation, or where Dad's an alcoholic. These are all bad situations. Right. And the law's already in place to take care of dads who beat their moms, right? That's already in place. That's called domestic violence law. And we already have a law that tries to prevent that from happening, because we understand that the ideal situation are two opposite-sex parents who are living in a peaceful, nonviolent home. And this is, I think, it is the ideal. And the best opportunity we give for young people, I believe, is to allow that to happen. Yeah. So is it a right or a privilege? I think it is a privilege more than a right, and I've tried to explain that a little bit on my article. Let me let you get the last word. Go ahead.
Well, I'll look at that article, because I think that was what I was going to come back to, is the privilege versus right, and I was just wondering if you've ever tried that out on someone who believes in same-sex marriage and if they're satisfied, because I think I would say, okay, call it whatever you want, then I want the privilege that you have.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's it's a thread in the larger argument, but for me, I can tell you that I'm only moved to take a stand on this at all because I think it's in the best interest of young people to be raised in the kind of family we're describing, and I would be no more vigorous about opposing same-sex marriage than I am vigorous in opposing violence in marriage. It's any marriage in which these conditions exist where you don't have two loving opposite-sex parents raising their kids. We need to do our best to encourage the loving nature of opposite-sex marriages. So I don't spend a lot of time harping on same-sex marriage, at least any more than I spend harping on the harmony that has to exist without violence in a marriage.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of, as a cop, I'm looking at it more from a perspective of, hey, what is that my duty to young people? And I've got 1 minute before the break, and I want to shoot over to Ian real quick. So, Brian, please forgive me.
Thanks
really
so
love that you called. I'll talk to you soon.
All right.
Okay, Ian, I got to you. I'm sorry to give you short notice on this. Maybe we can call back and get a little bit more, but you are calling from Gainesville, Florida, right?
Yes, sir.
And, you know, I've listened to you a number of times on the show when you called, Greg, so I feel like I know you already.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Happy New Year, and I'm going to get right into it because you got to go to break.
Do it.
I don't understand if Greg has the position. I don't know specifically what yours is. Greg has the position that is he seems to be an old earther, and he's okay with microevolution. He seems to be okay with microevolution, but not macroevolution. And I'm confused because you can see genetic drift over time, and you can demonstrate it and represent it. And you have 4.5 billion years, you know, for the small changes to be big changes. I don't see how you can not also accept speciation.
Right. And for me, of course, here we are coming to the end of this. Ian, here's what I want to do. I want to hold you over. Can I do that until
sure.
the next part of the show?
That's
so
fine.
We'll do that, and I'll do my commentary after my call with you. How's that sound? So hold on, and I'll get to you right after this break. Folks, having a great discussion here. If you want to join us, 1-800-227-5278. Next hour, we'll be going national with American Family Radio. Looking forward to being a part of that conversation with you. Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason.
This is the show your pastor warned you about.
Well, here we are, Stand to Reason Radio. Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel this week. We're here every Sunday from 2 to 5, but 3 to 5 on the American Family Radio Network, and that's probably where you're checking in right now. We just added this hour as the first hour with AFR. So we welcome all those stations who are joining us. Good to have you along for the ride. This is the place where we talk about ethics, value, and religion. You know, trying to give you something worth thinking about. And Greg is out teaching today, so I have the privilege of getting in to come in and sit in his stead. And really glad to do so. So thanks for joining us today. We've got Ian on the line holding from the last hour. We're going to get to you in a second, Ian. But before I do that, let me just remind you of something coming up here in March that's, I hadn't been teaching that weekend at Hume Lake because my intention was to go on this trip. And I teach at Hume occasionally, and that, of course, of all the weekends you could be teaching, that is the weekend I'm teaching there. But the Caribbean Cruise from Stand to Reason is coming up on March 17th to 24th, and we're coming close to a deadline here. This is a seven-day tour of the Caribbean, and this is a really unusual, relatively unusual kind of a tour because this is a tour you can bring your entire family to. And if you're somebody, you know, who's engaged in apologetics, you know, not everybody in our family necessarily is in love with apologetics the way that you and I might be if we listen to the show regularly. But I can tell you that it's in this context that everyone gets to jump in and see the value of clear thinking, the value of case making as a family. And I can tell you, just as a guy who's raised my kids in one form of ministry or pastoral ministry or another, that my young boys, for example, were quick to take a view of Christianity that was very similar evidentially to my own, simply because we did so much together as a family examining the truth claims of Christianity. Here's an opportunity for you to take your family and jump in and have the exact same experience, because not only will you be with the STR staff, of course, and Greg, of course, will be on that tour, and so will Alan, who will be there teaching different topics, but even Brett will be there with his family, and they'll be teaching topics that are geared for young people. It's never too soon to do, number one, to engage young people with these ideas, and number two, to make it a part of your family experience. My encouragement to you is to start that now, in any context you're in. If it's in your church setting, I loved the fact that in my church setting, I was actively involved with young people and my young people growing up, my kids growing up through that ministry. And if you're thinking about the best way to kind of launch out as a family and enjoy a vacation, this is the kind of thing that I would advance, only because you get a chance as a family to explore case-making Christianity. That tour is on March 17th to 24th. And as you'll see the details at the STR website, It's being organized by a company that is doing a great job of getting, making sure that everyone's together, everyone's jumped into the same program. But it's coming to a point now where there's a date coming up here where we're going to have to release back to the crews the extra unsold tickets that might be held right now for those listeners of STR. And lots of folks have already gotten as part of this trip. I just want to make sure if you're thinking about it, if you've been on the fence about it, now is the time to step over because our time is short and you don't want to miss a chance. You can go to str.org. You'll see the banner there. I send out an email once a month, too. I've got a banner included in my email that I send to all of you. So click that banner and get over to sign up for the Caribbean Cruise from Stand to Reason, March 17th to 24th. It's right around the corner. I've been talking about it for so long, it seems like, oh, it's still so far off. But we're already in 2012, and it's going to be here before you know it. All right, let's take a jump over now to the phone lines because Ian in Gainesville, Florida has been on hold. Hey, thanks for staying on hold, Ian. Let me just do this. Let me have you because we've got a bunch of folks who are joining us across the country on AFR, American Family Radio, and I want them to hear your position as well. So just kind of rearticulate your question for me.
Sure, and I'm right there with you. So I apologize. I was initially calling for Greg, and now you're here. And so it's based off of my understanding of his opinion, and hopefully you can shed some light on it. But my understanding is that Greg seems to be in an old world, an old earther.
Yes.
That he seems to be okay with microevolution. So if you can look and see, gene expression changes over time, viruses adapting to whatever situation, and you can look at the DNA and say, like, oh, look, there's this mutation over here, and you have 4.5 billion years, small changes over time, well, really 2 billion years, but whatever, small changes over time will eventually get to speciation. And so I'm confused as to where the disconnect is.
Okay, great. And of course, you know the danger, of course, in speaking for somebody else in their position. So what I'm about to tell you is kind of where I land on this issue. But I think we land in very similar places, Greg and I. So hopefully it'll give you some insight, and then you can kind of take the way I messed this up today, and you can call Greg back next week and say, what the heck was he talking about? But anyway, let me just throw out my thinking on this. I'm always very I'm not a biologist. I'm not a scientist. I've got one son who's extremely interested in these. His right now he's focused on genetics, and he's a pre-med student. Doesn't mean he's going to necessarily end up as an authority in these areas at all. But I'm constantly going back to him and saying, I want to know what you're learning that is either impacting the way we think about these issues or not. But in the end, I'm like you, unless you're a scientist. And, I don't know, do you have a background in the sciences also?
I'm actually at the University of Florida studying biochemistry.
Okay, great. You're probably in a very similar situation to my son. I don't know what level you're at and doing that. He's been working in labs for an amount of time also. And really what he's doing is he's working with DNA to try to find solutions to some cystic problems in kidneys and all those kinds of things. But anyway, the point is you probably have a very similar background. My whole goal is to look at the evidence that's in front of me and do my best to make something of it. And, of course, as a Christian, I'm going to always consider biblical evidence, but even I know that God has encouraged me to look at the world around me, the external world around me, and this is the world that he's, if my view is correct, this is the world that he has created, and there'll be evidence of validity in that world for me to examine. So here I am like you, looking at the evidence and trying to decide, what is the mechanism in place? I'm always uncomfortable with this word we use, evolution. Because inherent in the word is this idea that this process is somehow unguided by anything other than natural laws and mutations that occur in the DNA and the environment that then impacts on those two things. Do we agree on that at least, that from a perspective of what evolution is, that the part that I would say I'm least convinced about evidentially is the guidance issue. Is this an unguided process? And I'm careful not to say it's random, because I understand there are some natural laws that will prevent certain things. It's not completely random. It's just unguided. We agree on that?
It's a stretch, but I'll go with you.
Okay, well, why do you say it's a stretch? Let's at least get on kind of similar foundations, and then we'll go from there.
Well, just to say that the natural, I mean, whether it be sexual selection or just, the cheetah that doesn't waste a lot of energy sprinting for no apparent reason, that thing is going to not live very long to carry out. So it's not like that. There are guiding principles, But you're right that it's not like a firm, an outstretched hand, and a firm hand and an outstretched arm. It's not like that type of guiding, but I know where you're going.
Okay, well, no, let me, this is good. I'm glad you're talking to me about this because it helps me to refine the way I'm using language also, because that's the one thing I think I need the most is to be clear about what it is I believe and when I'm talking to you about it. What I mean in this situation is we would agree that something happens in the DNA that changes and provides us with a new version that then has to interact with its environment. And if this modification, this change is you know, you would argue that this change, if the natural environment impacts it in a certain way, which is advantageous for the species, the change is retained. And if it's not, then this eventually will die out. But I'm asking, what is it that causes that first mutation? Is that process just random? I try not to use that word because so many people I deal with would argue, well, no, you can't call that mutation random. So what we would agree, though, I think, is that it's unguided. Nothing is intentionally guiding it to change in a certain way. That the mutation occurs accidentally, in essence, through part of that reproduction of the DNA. And would we agree that that's what's happening in the DNA?
I would. And I could even describe to you, so our DNA is wicked long. It's like it wraps around the Earth if you were to uncoil it several times over.
Mm-hmm.
And so all along the way, there, you know, your body does an amazing job at copying that DNA. But every now and again, there's a coding error, and there are implements in place that kind of fix the coding error. But even in that, you know, editing process, you know, something might happen. And humans have a lot of junk DNA or non-coding DNA, but there's, you know, every now and again, something happens in a place where, and I would even go so far as to say, yes, it really is kind of random.
Okay, so here we are. This is where I think, for me, this is where my personal investigation, my personal interest is. Okay. Is this process that occurs in the DNA, is there enough time that a series of unguided mutations can bring us to where we need to go from nothing? Or are there times when it seems like the history of the planet resets itself and doesn't allow us the kind of time necessary, in which case the best and most reasonable explanation for us getting to a certain point is that someone is tinkering, something is tinkering. Maybe you could even argue, if you're a naturalist, that something in the natural experience of the planet is tinkering with the DNA to make larger leaps in the process to get us from one point to the other. And for me, this is really where I think, as a guy who was 35 years as an atheist and still really, I mean, that doesn't mean, by the way, when I say that, it doesn't give me credibility at all. You could be an unthinking atheist. And in many ways, I probably was an unthinking atheist. But my point is, I have a certain natural inclination towards skepticism, too. I won't just take the stock answer. I don't know exactly how Greg might land on this, but I know for me personally, the whole issue comes down to, is this rate of modification in the DNA best explained by a long series of small, unguided mutations, or does it seem like there's just not enough time? And this is where I think I would disagree with you. I'm trying to see, what is the evidence that leads you to believe that that would be enough time when it seems like there are places in the history of the planet where the history is just too inhospitable to these types of mutations? You know, I'm not going to go into all that, but the point is, I'm looking to say, hey, is there enough time for that kind of unguided process to bring us where we have to go? I think this is why I don't use the word evolution much. Evolution assumes this process is unguided. I do believe in change over time, but I believe it's guided. I'm not a poof creationist in the sense that I believe that we go from zero to poof, we're all here like some episode of South Park.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more looking at, how is it that God is authoring the code that eventually brings us humans, that brings us all of life on Earth? Is that a process that we can explain naturally with just, you know, unguided, if you want to call it random, mutation in the DNA code? Or is there some acceleration that's required that can only be best explained, most reasonably explained, as some type of intelligent intervention? I don't know. And this is one of the things that I'm looking at. And I have a view that I could come to as informed as a Christian, a biblical worldview. But when I look at the science of this as well, and if I just isolate my biblical worldview and stick it in my pocket for a second, as I look at the science for this, that's the key thing for me. In the end, it's going to be, is there enough time for this to occur, or does it seem that there's a rate of crazy acceleration at points that can best be explained by design interference? That's what I'm looking at.
Okay, so as I understand it, you're kind of okay with the how, but the why is where you get tripped up.
Well, I'm not so much the why. I mean, the why is a question I don't think that science can answer at all. I don't think science answers why questions. I think all science can do is answer what and how questions. The why questions are left to philosophy and theology, it seems to me. But the how and what questions, that's where I have my biggest concerns. I'm looking at this as well, and I just don't see. Now, good. One thing I don't do, Ian, is I don't spend a lot of time saying, well, you know, scientists used to believe this, and now they've changed their mind, as if that is somehow evidence that their views are can never be listened to again. I don't take that position. I'm just looking at the evidence itself and saying, gosh, I don't see how there's enough time to accomplish what has to be accomplished through this type of unguided process. I think there's more than enough time if the process is somehow guided. Then the question becomes, well, what? And also, if this is information, and this is where I think the real battle is DNA information? Maybe it's not. I think the best and most reasonable explanation is that it is, in fact, information. And if it is information, I think Stephen Meyer is right. I'm looking for another example anywhere in the history of science or the history of the planet where information did not come from an intelligent agent. If DNA is information, it's telling us something that can be altered by just changing the information, then how can we look at it as anything other than a product of intelligence? I don't know. Now, does this point to Christianity? No. Does this make a case for Christianity? No. But I think it does cause me to stop and think about the way I use the word evolution. Does it comport with Christianity? Yes. I think it does. But does it prove Christianity? No. But it's just one of those things I look at as one of the many pieces of circumstantial evidence you have to look at in unison, cumulatively, to make a case first for theism and then for the reliability of Scripture. And then for the resurrection. And these are the things that I tried to do when I first came to faith. First, what is the best cumulative explanation for the things I see in science? So I look at this, and I'm not convinced that there's enough time to do what needs to be done if this is an unguided process.
Are you familiar at all when population groups split off and go to islands, and this was, you know, I guess first documented, I suppose, with the finches, that Darwin first saw, but there are a number of island effect, in quotes, type of situations of a larger population group splits off into a smaller population group and is isolated from the larger population group. And because the smaller population group is limited in genetic variation, you have a much more rapid expression of what were recessive traits, what were unexpressed. And so there are instances, there's all kinds of instances that would kind of allow for rapid change over time.
You know, I would agree with you on that. I think there are all kinds of possible natural explanations that might account, especially in isolated species.
Right.
And, of course, we have to assume this has to occur for every species. In other words, it has to occur in a way that would account for all life we see on the planet. And I this is why I'm so careful, and I've been careful in my professional work and in my thinking on Christianity, to separate what's possible from what's reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt in my mind that that's possible. But given what we have to end up with, I don't think it's reasonable. And may it explain a certain species in a certain isolation? Absolutely. But I've got to ask the question, does that then do the heavy lifting necessary to explain everything? And I think although it's possible, it's not reasonable.
Okay. So you're okay with small amounts of genetic change over time. You're okay with, you know, these are the possible effects. But is it just the conclusion, or is it just because all of it together you're...
Well, when you say I'm okay with small genetic change, that's the one thing I'm most skeptical about. Is that
really?
That? No, what I mean is, let's be clear on my language. If you mean that I'm okay with the idea that we can get to where we are today through a process of small changes over time, no, I'm not okay with that. Now, if you're saying I'm okay with the idea that changes occur over time, I'm okay with that, of course.
Right.
Every Christian is okay with that, I would think, because we're going to argue that all of humanity is the product of one pair or at the end of several couples at the flood. Wherever you're going to put that funnel point, we're going to have to, as Christians, agree that all of humanity and all of its diversity comes from a single source of parents.
Okay.
So I think that all of us would agree that some modification occurs based on environment, but we would argue, I think, that most of us, and Greg, I think, would agree with me, that this is a design feature that is in who we are, on the product as a product of a designer who has designed us to not fall apart the first time an environmental change pushes the species, that instead we have some flex. We have some design flex. But to me, I still am looking for that thing that would explain species. Now, I realize that the idea that the term species has been hotly debated, and I kind of try to track along with all that as well. But I have not seen anything that persuades me that we can get where we are today from zero. Actually, to be honest, I'm not persuaded yet that anything can get the game started. And I think Greg uses a good analogy in that. Is it? I think that to argue that the biogenesis, the evidence for the initiation of life, should be separated from the evolutionary discussion, to me, is ridiculous. You've got a biological evolution on one side, chemical evolution on the other. The point is they're both evolution. We can't start this discussion unless we can figure out how we got here from nowhere. It'd be one thing if we were arguing, hey, we started off with pretty advanced forms of life and we had to just go a little bit. But to argue we had to come from nothing to this, I think, is a much different argument. And I'm still waiting for that evidence that would suggest to me that it can occur without any kind of intelligent acceleration. That's just where I'm at. Just so you know. Now that may not be exactly where Greg's at, but I hope that kind of helps you to see where I'm coming from. And I think it probably is pretty close to where Greg stands on that issue as well. Listen, we're up against a break again. And I didn't even get my monologue in today, and I spent so much time preparing, but I thought your call is more important. And by the way, I love when you call the show. I love hearing your discourse with Greg, and please don't stop calling. All right, so thanks for calling, Ian. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year to you and you and yours.
You too, bud. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so let's take a break right now, our first break of this hour, our first hour with American Family Radio. Call us at 1-800-227-5278. Almost got you calling the wrong number. And locally here in Southern California, you can reach us at 714-754-4150. Jay Wallace sending in for Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg Kokel here, inviting you to a conference you won't soon forget. The location? The Eastern Caribbean. Join us as we set sail March 17, 2012, from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for 8 days aboard Holland America's MS Eurodam for an unforgettable trip to Grand Turks and Caicos Islands, San Juan, Puerto Rico, St. Thomas and the Virgin Islands, and Half Moon Cay in the Bahamas. I'll be joined by Stand to Reason Student Impact Director Brett Kunkel and STR speaker and trainer Alan Schliemann for a lineup of conference sessions that will stimulate your thinking and equip you with practical skills. Everything about this trip is being planned with your enjoyment and enrichment in mind. And this year we're planning some special youth sessions led by Brett, so plan on bringing the family and enjoying great times of fellowship and spiritual deepening together. Not only will you be challenged with stimulating presentations, you'll have a chance to ask questions in open forum discussions and enjoy the interaction and fellowship with both our speakers and your fellow passengers on deck, sharing great meals together and ashore as we enjoy the splendor of the Eastern Caribbean's beautiful resort ports. So save the dates and contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours. That's 800-247-1899. They're assisting Stand to Reason with their trip, and their skilled staff is committed to answering all your questions and helping to make this a memorable experience. You can also visit our website at str.org for all the information. I hope to see you there in the Caribbean with Stand to Reason.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? STR.org is a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for. Before you turn to Google, log on to STR.org, and you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse the range of topics, from our radio archives to advanced online training to our blog. You'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from STR.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ and the tactics that will help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. Your visit to STR.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you take a stand for the truth. So visit today. That's STR.org.
Glad to be back with you here, Stand to Reason Radio. We're contending for the Christian worldview. the place where Greg Kokel usually sits in this seat. I am sitting in for him, J. Warner Wallace, and looking forward to taking calls. I've got one person on hold right now. The other lines are open for you at 1-800-227-5278. We can talk about anything in the area of ethics, values, and religion. You name it, we'll talk about it. But before we get to that, I wanted to take a little bit of time to discuss with you something that I've noticed in the last couple of years that I think the investigation of cold cases, and that's what I do for a living. I investigate cold cases. And I think that process has taught me a little bit that has helped me to examine the scriptures and understand the things that I think I see in the scriptures that give a lot of people pause that really ought not give people pause at all. And one of these things is the identification and the separation between what is evidence and what is an artifact. And this is something maybe you haven't thought about much, but we have in the scripture we possess in front of us, whatever version and whatever translation of the Bible you might be holding today, that Bible is filled with largely evidence from the first century about the life of Jesus. The New Testament is, anyway. But in the midst of all that evidence, there are some artifacts. Let me explain what I mean. In every crime scene, you're going to find that there's evidence and there are artifacts present in the crime scene. Evidence are those things that are the direct result of the activity that was related to the crime that took place in that crime scene. Every crime that occurs in a crime scene leaves certain forms of evidence in place. We can find those evidence pieces of evidence later and kind of reassemble what happened in the crime scene. But in addition to those pieces of evidence that are in the crime scene, there are lots of artifacts that aren't related to the crime at all. And you know what? When we go out there and we tape off that area and we use CSI to collect all that evidence, we scoop up everything. We scoop up the evidence and we scoop up the artifacts. And it's up to us later to distinguish which is which. So, for example, if I have a terrible crime scene where someone's stabbed, I may have artifacts that exist in the crime scene before the crime even occurs. Let's give you an example of this. Maybe the day before the crime occurs, someone walks through it and loses a button. And the button is laying in the crime scene for a whole day, and no one even knows it's really there. And then a crime occurs in that scene, and every little piece of information is important now. And sure enough, that button, which was there for a whole day before the crime even occurred, gets collected. And then I've got to figure out, my gosh, did that button come from the suspect? Did that button come from the victim? Sometimes in some of these terrible scenes, I've got the paramedics will arrive shortly before the police and try to resuscitate the victim, and they make a mess. Let me tell you, they destroy your crime scene. And in the end, I end up with all kinds of materials, shoe prints, smudges, all kinds of things that are caused not by the victim, not by a suspect in that crime scene, but by the first responders who were trying to save the victim's life. These are artifacts. The button's an artifact, all the gear and smudges and the mess that's created by the first responders. Those are all artifacts. They're not evidential. They're not going to tell me anything about what happened at the scene. And I guarantee you, when we get to trial, the defense is going to make a big deal out of artifacts and are going to want the artifacts to be seen as evidence, especially if the artifacts can kind of point away from their defendant. Every trial I've ever done I've had to spend some time assessing and figuring out what is evidence and what is an artifact. Now, sometimes I'm lucky. I can find out which is which by doing a little investigation of my own. Sometimes, for example, it's just in the illustration of the button. What if, a day after the crime, I'm discussing some of the evidence and I'm talking to witnesses and I discover that the victim's sister happened to be walking through and tore her blouse on a car door, and sure enough, the button came off her blouse, and she shows me her blouse and the button's missing, and sure enough, the button matches the buttons on the blouse. Well, sure enough, now I can actually identify the artifact, can't I? And I can make a strong case that this is an artifact. It's not to be considered as part of the case. And as a matter of fact, that artifact that's in the crime scene really shouldn't dissuade us from understanding the truth of the case, because the evidence is still there. We know what's evidential. And we now can close our eyes for a second. We can discount the button, because the button is not part of the scene. Now, a lot of this cast, I bring this up because sometimes we see a struggle and we see skeptics raise issues with the scripture in order to persuade us that we cannot trust the scripture at all. And they'll do it by pointing to those areas of the scripture that they can argue are either late additions or they should not be part of the scriptural text. And one of the most famous, of course, is the story of the woman caught in adultery, right, that you see in John 7. It's in John 7, starting in verse 53. It runs all the way through chapter 8, verse 11. It's the famous story where the adulterous woman is brought into Jesus, and you know, he writes in the sand, writes in the dust, and he, you know, if you, you know, who has never sinned should cast the first stone. You're familiar with the story. It's a beloved story. It's one of my favorite stories about Jesus. Now, the problem with the story is that it appears that it was a very late addition to the text. That's one of the problems. I would say that this is really not evidence of Jesus that we find in the scriptures, but it is in fact an artifact that appears along with the evidence. And I say that because we do have some good reason to believe that it was not in the earliest known manuscripts. It's not present, for example, in Papyri 66, which is about a 200 AD version. It's not present in Papyri 75 in the 3rd century. It's not present in Codex Sinaiticus in the 4th century. It's not present in Codex Vaticanus in the 4th century. The first time it actually appears in its entirety is in the 5th century, a codex from the 5th century. And so if you look at this, there's good reason, I think, and I've kind of looked at it in detail to see, you know, should I believe this is a legitimate early part of the manuscript that belongs in the, now you can make a case for it, and I have seen people try to make a case. It's certainly within the character of Jesus, isn't it? That story is certainly within the character of Jesus, but it's one of those few places in the scripture where we can look at it, and once we have a collection, this is why it's so important, by the way, to have large collections of manuscript evidence, because we can compare these to each other and determine where the variations exist, what we believe about those variations. And in this particular case, I think there's good reason to believe that this particular story is a late edition, based on the number of early editions, early existing manuscripts in which this story is not present. As a matter of fact, it doesn't even always appear in the Gospel of John. This particular piece appears in the Gospel of Luke in some manuscripts. So, I mean, if you look at this piece, I would have to argue that this appears to me to be an artifact and not evidence. Now, there are a few more small, by comparison to this, very small and very few passages of Scripture that also appear to be artifacts rather than original pieces of evidence that existed in the original manuscript. I won't go through all of those with you. But here's my point. Like the button, if we can identify that this is an artifact, why would we have any hesitation about simply putting it in the box for a second and going back to what we know as evidence and making our case from the evidence once we've demonstrated what is in fact an artifact? We do this every day. It does not denigrate our case in the least. We simply have to be able to make a case that this is an artifact. Now, when it comes to biblical inerrancy, we've always argued that we believe that the scriptures are inerrant in their original form. And I would take that same position. This late artifact in the scripture does not give me pause. It does not cause me to doubt that all of scripture can be trusted. It's simply my job as an investigator of either crime scenes or of the Christian worldview to identify what is an artifact. And let me tell you a simple strategy that I use that might help you to think about what is an artifact and what is evidence. First, I've got to identify what I would call our late additions. Now, look, you know, officers, when we get to a crime scene, we tape it off. And we take a lot of photographs. And we have these snapshots of the early crime scene. And if something comes into the crime scene late, like let's say, you know, now we've taped it off and someone rushes in to help a victim or something happens afterwards, we now know that anything that's photographed later, if it doesn't exist in the earliest photographs of the crime scene, it's a late addition. We have early snapshots of the scriptures. If we find something that pops up later, we can assume that it's an artifact and not evidence, and we have good reason to believe that, and it should not take away from us for a second from what we – it'd be one thing, for example, if the major claims of Christianity were all late additions we could demonstrate, but that is not the case. The earliest versions of Scripture, the earliest versions of the eyewitness accounts, the earliest snapshots of the crime scene include every essential tenet and belief of the Christian worldview. And so this late scene of the adulterous woman, which is certainly within the character of Jesus, I have no problem with it being a late addition. If it's not in the first photographs of the crime scene, okay. It's an artifact. It doesn't change the case for Christianity one bit. I also want to recognize the differences in character that might exist in a crime scene. So, for example, I know when a late responder comes in, first responder rather comes in to treat the victim, that he's going to have medical gear that's got all tubing, bandage wrapping, paper, all that kind of stuff's going to be in there. I can clearly see on the character of that other type of material that it's not part of the crime. It's part of the paramedic's box of tricks, right? It's part of the stuff that he uses to fix people. I get that. And his character is different enough that I can see it and call it out. Sometimes late additions or additions to the manuscripts we have of the biblical record are equally different in character, and we can look at them and understand that they're artifacts on the basis of their difference in character. I'm also looking for an explanation, something that might explain why this artifact is in the crime scene to begin with, that would eliminate the artifact altogether. You know, for example, I once had a footprint in a crime scene that I thought would belong to the suspect. And I later was able to figure out by doing interviews that it really belonged to the victim's landlord who walked through the crime scene. And that person was actually the first person to find this particular victim. And so that footprint really ended up being something that I could demonstrate. I had an explanation as to why it was there and was not part of the evidential package. This also happens sometimes when we're studying scripture. We've got a reason. We can see something pop up. I'll give you an example of this. You might see occasionally in scripture a place where a scribe years later is trying to make a better case for some theological position. Maybe, for example, the 1 John 5:7 is a good example. In the King James Version, it says, "For there are three that bear record in heaven, the Father, the Word, and the Holy Ghost, and these three are one." You find the most distinct expression of the Trinity in the KJV in that verse. The problem, of course, is that it only appears in a couple of places in manuscript history. Doesn't appear in any manuscript until the 16th century. There's good reason to believe this is an artifact. But my whole point is, like any other crime scene, I can look for an explanation as to why this might be an artifact that's in the crime scene to begin with. Here I can see a sense in which somebody wants to make a stronger case for the Trinity in a place where it's really close. So he adds a line. But because we have good snapshots of the crime scene early, we know it's a late addition. And the fact that this might exist in the manuscript doesn't give me any pause, because I know that the other evidences, which are legitimate pieces of evidence, make the case on their own. One of the other things I do is I try to see what happens to my case if I include this thing that's an artifact. So, for example, I find a button. And in the end, I can't make the button to the victim or to any suspect. Yet I've got 10 pieces of evidence that point to a specific suspect in mind. The button then becomes an anomaly, right? I could include it in my consideration. Will it change who the bad guy is? No, because the other 10 pieces already make the case for that bad guy. I can exclude it from the thing. Will it change? No, it won't change anything in or out. So I can look at that artifact and say, well, regardless if it's an artifact in the crime scene, it doesn't change the crime scene. Same thing is true in Scripture sometimes. When you get a verse that comes in, you say to yourself, okay, the passage about the adulterous woman, let's put it in. Does it change anything about what we know about Jesus? Does it change his claims to the resurrection? Does it change anything? His claims to deity? No. In or out, it makes no difference in terms of what we know about Jesus. This is similar to the process I take in crime scenes. And the last thing I want to pass on to you is that in a crime scene, I try my best to rely on what I do know without, you know, guessing and hyperventilating over what I don't know. Clearly, if I've got 10 good reasons evidentially to believe a particular suspect did a certain thing, that's what I do know. And if there's one unexplained anomaly that may, in fact, be an artifact, and I can't even demonstrate for sure where it came from, and that does happen. Almost every single crime scene I've got, there's some anomaly in the crime scene. I can't explain where it came from. But I do know what I do know. And I trust and rely on the evidence I have to make the case. And as it turns out in Scripture, there is a lot that we do know from the evidence. And the existence of any artifact in the crime scene doesn't cause me any concern at all. And it shouldn't cause you any concern either. All right, so I just want to talk a little bit about evidence in a crime scene. I hope that helps you a little bit. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back to your calls, 1-800-227-5278, and locally, 714-754-4150, right here on Stand to Reason Radio.
We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions no matter who you're talking to by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material, too, by using the brand-new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org or call 1-800-2-REASON.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel, and boy, am I excited to offer you my new book, Tactics. It's a book that I wrote to help you discuss your Christian convictions with non-Christians, and it outlines specific steps to follow that you can take that will help those conversations be less intimidating and more effective. And we've seen a tremendous response to this book, and many people have already told me how much it will help them. And I hope it will help you too. To get a copy for yourself or as a gift, simply visit tacticsbook.com. It's my aim to help you make a difference for the kingdom with this book. To order your copy, simply visit tacticsbook.com.
Glad to be back with you here. Jay Warner Wallace sitting here for Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason and taking us down to the things that matter most in life. And this is the place that Greg typically does that, and I'm glad to be in his stead, and I tell you, it's not easy. I never had more respect for Greg than I did the first time I sat in this chair and tried to do this job. And mostly it's because you just don't know who's going to call. And those two things I could probably talk about, no one ever seems to call on those two things. So I have to do my best to kind of ramp up on the other issues. And I'm teasing, of course, but it is not an easy job. So those of you who are listening to this radio show and love what Greg does here, I love it even more because I've had to do it myself. So just want to throw that out to you. Let's go to Nathan in Las Vegas for a good question about intellectual honesty. Okay, Nathan, I've got you on the line. How are you doing?
Hi, Jay.
Good to talk to you.
Is it okay to call you Jay? Or
you can call me Jim. Please, it's fine. Please, call. This would be great.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for waiting so long. I appreciate it. Go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. My question I was going to say is actually not on the two things either. So
okay, cool.
Sorry about that.
No problem.
You know, I have a friend. I want to give a little background. I have a friend. I've been talking to him about, you know, traditional Christianity. He calls himself a Christian. We've been talking for approximately a year about this, and but, you know, he ultimately brings this kind of Eastern Hindu mysticism kind of stuff, and he sprinkles it all over Christianity, and he wants to call it Christianity.
Right.
And so we're trying to work through that. I'm trying to get at the truth of it all. And right now we're in our particular conversation. I'm dealing with – he's giving me verses to try to prove his particular point of view, like, for example, God is love. And then – but, you know, taking it out of context and trying to apply it. And then I'm trying to show him context. And he's kind of like the kangaroo in the boxing ring, you know, the cartoon where the guy's trying to punch the kangaroo, but the kangaroo is just jumping all over the place.
Right, exactly. Slippery.
And, you know, when I show something to him, like, you know, when he denies that God demands justice and, you know, all of the other, you know, character attributes that God is that we get from traditional Christianity, then he just kind of says, well, you know, portions of the Bible are not accurate, and he's just squirmy. So ultimately, he's being intellectually dishonest. And I just want to call it for what it is, but I don't know how to, how should I approach this?
Well, I think you're a couple of things. Let me just say on this that my experience here in this area, and I've got a similar experience. You know, I do a lot of work with LDS. I've taken missions trips to Utah a number of times, and I've got a lot of LDS family. And I discovered the same kind of thing happens where you'll find they'll step into the scripture, into our scriptures, and they'll use the King James Bible to do it. And they'll step into the scriptures to make a case. But then, of course, if you try to show them where the context of that case is really doesn't describe what they're saying it describes, that's when they'll usually default to, well, that's because every part of scripture is not necessarily trustworthy. So you find them kind of picking and choosing. You almost want to say to start, okay, time out. Let's do this. You tell me the places in the scripture that aren't reliable right now. We'll just start scratching those out. So all we have left is stuff that you cannot ultimately say, well, you know, that's an unreliable portion of scripture. Because if we had that list up front of all the areas that you think that are not reliable, then we could just avoid those. But typically they only bring those up when you've backed them into a corner because they've taken something out of context. So I know what you're talking about, and there is a sense of intellectual dishonesty that's occurring there. There's no doubt about it. So let me just tell you what my tactic has been in the past. And I hate talking about the thing that Greg has written a book about, tactics. I'm hesitant always. Number one, no one's a better expert than Greg. No doubt about that. But also, I don't want people to think that my goal here is just to be tactically, you know, because I've seen great tactical defense attorneys who are brilliant tactically, but they don't possess the truth. We have a great advantage. We happen to possess the truth, and we owe it to each other to do the heavy lifting that Greg has done for us and to read that, to know how to be tactical in our approach, right? But I'm always afraid that people, my skeptical friends, are going to say, well, see, you're just a good, being good tactically, but you're just, it's a kind of, they see it as a form of trickery almost.
Right, yes. Yeah.
But let me just explain to you where I'm coming from. You do have to be very careful with people who you, at some point in the course of your conversation, you come to the point where you realize, you know what, he's not going to, I don't care what I say, he's going to find a way to wiggle on this because he's not really being honest. When that, you get to that point, let me tell you how I shift. I do what Greg has taught me to do years and years ago before he ever wrote anything on this, as far as a book goes. I go back to Columbo questions. I stop making claims that they can wiggle from. I simply examine their claims, and I ask them questions which expose those claims. Because in the end, if you believe this person's being intellectually dishonest with you, you're going to want to demonstrate that dishonesty. And it's time to stop making claims of your own. It's time instead to show them repeatedly how their claim doesn't really work. And I stop making a case for Christianity at that point, and I simply say, well, tell me why you believe that. And they'll give me a reason why they believe this particular thing. And then I'll say, well, okay, have you thought about this, though? It doesn't make any sense given this. And then they'll shift.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say, okay, well, tell me why you believe that. Well, that doesn't make any sense because of this. And they'll shift again. Now I've got three or four shifts in the conversation. At that point, I think it's fair for you and I to say, gosh, you know, it seems like either you haven't thought through that position that carefully because you seem to be shifting it a lot, or you're really – I don't think this is the case, but maybe I'm wrong. Are you being intellectually dishonest with me? Are you really – either you're shifting because you don't realize you're shifting, or you're shifting intentionally. Just help me to understand which it is. That's a fair question to ask. And at some point, I don't want the conversation to be about my 18 claims that they have tried to knock down, but I'd rather it be about their 18 claims that they've backed up on themselves because they're shifting in response to our objections. And I think that's me. I want to be able to show them because in the end they're going to say, well, what do you mean I'm being dishonest? Well, here's why. A few minutes ago you said this, but then you changed it to that, and then you changed it to this. And I need to have that trail of changes that I can point to. It's just like when you're talking to somebody who's committed a crime. In the end, I'm not going to offer a lot of information. I need to get the information I can from him. And I want him to give me the most robust version. Along the way, I'm going to find myself saying, really? Well, if it happened that way, what about this? I'll see a shift. Okay, really? If it happened that second way, well, what about this? I'll see another shift, and then I'm in a position down the road to either talk to a jury about all those changes or to talk to him about all those changes. And that starts to sound like you're not telling me the truth when you make a lot of changes in your statement, right? That's
right.
One of the things we look at as detectives. The same thing happens with our friends when they make a lot of changes in their claims because they know that they can't stand on the old position anymore. And I think it is fair for you. At some point in every conversation I've had with a suspect, I've had to say, okay, now let me just lay out these changes, and you tell me how I can make sense of these because it seems to me like you're lying to me. And maybe I'm wrong. But I think I want to ask you, explain to me how all these – now, I first have to have the changes on the table before I can bring them to his attention. And you have the same obligation. Get those changes on the table and then bring those changes to their attention. And let's see how they land this. And in the end, be prepared. There have been lots of folks who are not going to move. They have no intention of moving. Are you okay with that?
Yeah, I guess. Well, you know, I was going to ask you that question too. It's a hypothetical question. You know, what happens? Because I'm, you know, I've said this to my brothers and sisters at my fellowship, you know, that I go to and at the church. Speaking about this friend that I have, he was my best man at my wedding. I mean, I'm only a new Christian about 3 years, and I care about him deeply. That's why we are in this conversation.
Right.
But, you know, he's the worst case scenario. He's got to be. And, you know, he's very stubborn. So what happens hypothetically, you get him to the point and I show him all these things, but then, you know, there's that moment like you're talking about. I mean, what is, that's probably a dumb question, but what happens then?
Yeah, in that moment, that's when I want to be the most transformational in the language I use, because this may be the last time he's going to let you in on this conversation, or it may not be. But sometimes when I'm doing street evangelism, or I'm talking to my family at a holiday gathering or at a vacation, I mean, at some point I'm going to have to leave, and the vacation's over, the holiday is over, or the opportunity in the street is over. At some point, I've got to leave them with something that will, as Greg always says, puts a stone in their shoe. Something that will cause them to at least think clearly. And it may be that they're in such denial that there's one of two things you can leave them with. One is some provocative piece of evidence that you've offered that will cause them to think. But in this case, it may simply be a series of contradictions that they've made that they should at least consider their own contradictory positions. Because this is about intellectual dishonesty. So I think the last thing I would leave them with is, gosh, this is what I think I heard you say today. You gave me three things here, and you have to mine that out in the conversation. You have to be very intentional about mining those contradictions out. And once you've got them, say, hey, you know, just tell me, if what if you were me, and you saw me giving you three contradictions that always occur at the point of investigation, when I prod a little deeper, you change the story, would you come away thinking that I really hold to this position because it's true, or I hold to this position because I refuse to see the truth? Which of these two things does it sound like when you see me making those kinds of contradictions? And I just want to leave that question on the table for you. I'm not going to tell you how I landed. You got to think about it yourself. But if you were me, where would you land it? I think that's enough for me to walk away at that conversation at that point, and just that's the stone I have to leave in their shoe. And sometimes that stone, honestly, Nathan, sometimes that stone is a great piece of evidence that they will look at and go, yeah, I hadn't considered that. But in this case, it may simply be the list of their own contradictions, so they can, if they at some point in that quiet moment when they think to themselves, yeah, maybe either I'm inconsistent in my views, or maybe I have been. And I think sometimes when we do this, we know who we are. We know what we're doing. But at least I don't want you to walk away and have this guy think that you didn't see exactly what he was doing. And that's enough of a wake-up call for a lot of people. Whatever I'm doing, it's pretty obvious because Nathan pointed it out to me. So I hope that helps a little bit. And I'm going to quickly go to another call.
It really helps.
Hey, Nathan, I appreciate your call. I'm going to take one more before the break. Thanks, Nathan. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, I think I've got Mike. Am I right? Do I have Mike or do I have Wayne? Who do I have?
My name is Wayne.
Wayne, how are you? I jumped over one call to you by accident, but these calls are very similar. So Wayne, let's go to your question about evolution.
No, I would like to make a comment and offer a reference. And also, but I'd like to thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
For being on air. I think what you're doing is very important.
Thanks, appreciate it. I was
listening in on your discussion earlier about how did we get to the variety of human shall we say, characteristics. Some people call it race. But from a science standpoint of view and a history standpoint of view, I glean that this is nothing more than what I call sorting. In the animal world, you know, if you're a dog person or a horse person, you call it breeding. But I think there's no evidence that evolution, if you think that there is any evolution at all, has anything to do with this, but I think that the Bible supports you in your statements concerning that there's no evolutionary process that mandates this or creates the end variation. I think what's going on, as I said before, we start with it's a sorting that started with the DNA string that was intact, fully intact, on creation with Adam and Eve, and then as people reproduced, you had different combinations, and some of those combinations went off and lived in isolation and created such things as we call race today. And the reference that I would like to leave with you is a book written by Ken Ham called One Blood. And I think he does a good job in explaining this.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, when you were doing the break after the call, Linda and I were talking about this, and Linda made a good point that I've often made myself, and I should have mentioned it to Ian as well, is that there's a sense in which I'm looking to see, does any of this interaction in the DNA ever produce new information? If DNA is new as information, is there any evidence that evolution produces new information, or is every mutation we see either a denigration or a loss of information, a change of information for the negative, or a loss of information altogether? And can you, at what point can we go backwards and pick up new information? I'm still looking to see if that occurs. I'm always hesitant, though, if I'm honest with you, Wayne, because I know that I don't have a science background. So like everybody else, I'm trusting some other authority for this. But that's one of the things that I'm looking at to say, hey, I think that would be necessary. If DNA is information and we're going to inform a new process, we'd have to have new information appear that would help us do that. And that's one of the things I'm hesitant about, too. Listen, I'm going to jump from your call, Wayne, to Mike in New York. Wayne, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it. Okay.
Well,
thanks, bud. Okay, over to Mike. I thought I was going to you first, and I got to you second, but I did get you to you, Mike. How you doing, bud?
No problem, man. I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing great, and you're going to talk about evolution and DNA and proteins a little bit, right?
Yeah. The one thing when I talk to evolutionists or when I'm taking a class on evolution, the main point that I see that they overlook a lot and which troubles me, and I've never been able to find an answer. My reason for the call was to see if you had any. You know, if you've stumbled across information or if anyone has explained it to you. But when the DNA itself, when it's duplicating or replicating itself, what happens is it enlists the help of several different proteins. Like, for example, the helicase protein, it'll basically wedge in between the two strands and split it open. Then you have, like, the DNA primase that'll start laying down the complementary base pairs and things like that. But the problem with that situation is the actual protein itself is encoded in the DNA that it is unwinding and replicating. So from the way I see it is that it's looking like kind of like the whole chicken and the egg scenario. What came first? Were the proteins there first or was the DNA there first? You know, do you see where I'm going with
this? Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, one of the things I use to train when I'm training people on this topic is there are several great computer animation videos of the process of DNA replication in the cell. I'm sure you've seen these. And it shows the entire mechanistic kind of inworking of what's occurring in the cell in order to do this kind of – and it really shows cellular machines that are of a level of sophistication. Like you said, it is a chicken and egg problem because these are also being encoded in the DNA even as they are working on the DNA to replicate it. So I have the same problem that you do. One of the things that was very powerful for me was looking at these computer generated animations of all of the working components, all the molecular machines, the protein machines that exist in the cell to do this work. Not only are these machines doing the work, they are working in unison with other machines to do the work. And the information that's required to inform this process to me is, I think, is highly problematic. These are one of the things that I look at and say, wow, I just one viewing of that animation for me leaves me with the question, how in the world could we believe that this intricate, complex, and it seems in many ways irreducibly complex, a system in the cell could be the product of anything other than a design effort? That, I mean, I think you bring it up perfectly when you talk about the protein machines that do the replication. What is your background, Mike, in terms of your – are you a science major or how did you learn about this?
Well, I did an undergrad in biology. Right now I'm actually driving up to my school. I'm a third-year medical student, so I've dealt a lot with when I took my biochemistry courses and stuff like that. They don't really – they never address that. I mean, it's not really – For medicine, you don't really need to know about, every detailed interaction. But, the questions do pop up when I'm sitting there studying for, an exam or something. And like, oh, that's interesting. And then I'll just kind of flip through. I never really discuss it, with a professor. I mean, I have asked one when I was an undergrad. They really don't have that, that great of answers for me. But as far as I remember, when you were talking to, I believe it was Wayne earlier, you asked if the information, does it get created or anything like that? I mean, if you want to go the route of, on a species level, like such as a human being, then, it's very difficult to produce an example where information is being added. But if you look at, bacteria and things like that, you can see a change of information, and the change of information actually benefits the bacteria. But that's due to a direct result of, you know, humans trying to kill them with antibiotics.
Well, I can see this. I can see that as God is using you in your setting, I think that you are bringing great questions to your professors. I wish we had more time to talk about it, but that's exactly what I'm hoping for, is more like us who will ask the important questions, and that's what we're trying to do right here at Stand to Reason. Well, sitting down here at the microphone for Greg Kokel, this is Jay Warner Wallace on a beautiful, beautiful Sunday. And here it is, a football Sunday. So if you're listening to this live, you get 50 extra credit points for tomorrow's exam, okay? Because you're not watching football. You DVR'd the football, or you said nothing is more important than than your God, and you will not watch football. Either one of those two decisions was accurate and worthy of great respect. Here I am sitting in for Greg, who's not watching football either. I can tell you, though, our comrade Brett Kunkel is watching football. I wanted to just make that point. Anyway, no, I shouldn't have said that. He's going to get me later for that. You know, actually, he had a big party yesterday. I was hoping to talk to him today. But we are so blessed, because whenever I come in here to sit in for Greg, and I get a chance to do that occasionally, Melinda always does the best job of providing me with really great guests that I think are making a huge impact on the culture around us. And it always ends up being some example that I want to follow. Now, like you, I'm somebody who's always been interested in apologetics. Maybe you have or you haven't, but you are now listening to this show, probably for that same reason. And you're probably wondering, if you're like me, I was, this guy who worked as a cop, came to faith late in life, began to do investigations and started to apply some of that kind of thinking to the Christian worldview. And then I wondered, how is it I'm going to be able to make an impact on my world as a new Christian? I want to be a casemaker. I'm a casemaker in almost everything else I do professionally. I want to be a casemaker in my Christian worldview. And how do I do that in a way that is powerful? How do I get involved where the battle really is? How do I get in the game? And maybe you're like me and you're asking that same kind of question. Well, I have a guest today who I think is going to help us to see, first of all, an example of how to get in the game, and then also perhaps even an opportunity for us to join in the action. And I've got a chance to interview authors before and a chance to interview other Christian speakers. But today I get a chance to talk to somebody who is really, I think, leading a charge. And I want to see if you agree with me. I think you will. And let's just see what we can do to be involved and engaged in that activity as well. His name on the line with me right now is Rick Shanker. Now, Rick, you're on the line with me. I want to ask you, am I even pronouncing your name correctly? Rick, are you on with me? Let's just see if I've got you on the line. I think I do. And if I don't, I know that Barbara will solve that problem as we speak. Let me tell you a little bit about Rick Shanker so you know. He's president of an organization called Ratio Christi. And this is an organization that is campus-based. It's an apologetics organization. And he's a president of this organization. He joined in February of 2011. And in that short period of time, he's done something quite remarkable. Rick's got a bachelor's degree in Bible from Central Bible College. He's done his graduate work at Regent University in public policy. And he's even held an elected office in Erie, Pennsylvania. As a matter of fact, that's why we're on the radio right now doing a phone interview, because, Rick, you're still back in Pennsylvania, right? Let's try one more time. I think we've got him. Do we have him, folks? Well, let me continue just to tell you a little bit more about him. This is the beauty of live radio, isn't it? Let's just try it now and see if you've got Rick. Are you on the line with me now?
I'm here.
Oh, for crying out loud! Well, I'm so glad to talk to you. I was getting a little bit worried there, but when this is what happens when you do live radio on a phone line. Sometimes I have in studio guests, and I'm just so delighted you could join us today. Thanks for getting on the phone and talking to us all the way from. Are you in Pennsylvania today? Is that where you are?
I'm in Erie, Pennsylvania, and I'm not watching football.
Good for you. See? But it's only because you're stuck talking to me, probably, huh? That's why. I hope you're DVRing the game. Well, I'll usually just follow along afterwards and watch it on TV. But thanks for joining us today. I really am excited about talking to you because I think what you're doing is very innovative. And it's part of the the bloodline that I think Brett Kunkel and I just are so passionate about young people and how to engage young people and how to do the work to prepare young people to be case makers and change makers in their culture. And I think you seem to be at the front line in a very innovative way. So first of all, just give me a second and tell me a little bit about your background before you ever launched into this organization. What did God do with you to prepare you for this?
I am really a grassroots political organizer. I built a huge grassroots organization in Pennsylvania for Christian causes. I met a lot of political folks, including Tom Ridge and Rick Santorum. Ended up going to work for Tom Ridge for a while, and eventually ran for office myself and won. I was kind of known in the state for a person knowing how to build grassroots organizations. But after being in elected office for a while, my heart was yearning more to be directly involved in a ministry that would reach out into the church and protect the bride, if you will, you know, the people within the church with the knowledge of how our faith can stand up to intellectual scrutiny. And I wanted to get involved in something after I left office, but I didn't know what. And sometime around early 2010, I was getting the sense, and I assume this is wisdom from God, because I see it happening, that the church was heading into the age of the apologist. Well, you know, in Bible college, I think I read one book in apologetics, and that was it. And I didn't know much about it, so I started to do some research, investigation, looking at different websites, listening to podcasts from people like Ravi Zacharias. And I told my wife that I thought I might go and get my master's in apologetics. And she said, "What are you going to do with that?" And I said, "I don't know, become a FedEx delivery man or something? I can't figure out what these people do once they get their degree, because it didn't look to me like, you know, the churches were hiring them and there were only a few ministries." But anyway, as I was looking at doing that, I ran into a website off of one of the seminaries' website, off of Southern Evangelical Seminary website.
Okay.
For an organization called Ratio Christi. It was a student-run organization by the students of SES. It was one of their outreach programs. And as soon as I looked at it, I said to myself, that thing is a mass movement ready to happen. And, you know, this is part of that political background, you know, being able to spot trends that can become mass movements.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I said to my wife, I said, that's what I want to do when I grow up. I want to run that thing. Now, here I am, 50-some years old, you know, completely out of politics, looking for some kind of Christian work. So I called up the folks at SES, the students that were running this, and said, listen, I'm not asking you for anything. I want to run that organization. I take it from what I'm seeing, you don't have any money, you don't have a corporation, you don't have a 501c3, you don't have anything, you don't need to give me anything, just let me run this and I'll turn it into something big because I believe God wants to get behind this thing. And so that's how I got involved in this. It actually took them 8 or 9 months to be convinced that I was the right person to do this and taking it independent of them and run the organization. That was kind of funny. I told my wife, geez, I can't even volunteer for a job, you know?
So. Yeah, no kidding. You had a big dream for that job, though, as well. Let me just drop in before you finish and just tell you that this is so exciting to me, and here's why. I host a website called Please Convince Me, and I listen to Greg's podcast. You know, Greg's been so influential in my life. But we often get email. I know Greg gets it, and I get it, from people who, like you suggested, have even spent the time to educate themselves in apologetics. And what you say is absolutely spot on. For those of us who have gone so far as to get master's degrees and this or that, then you wonder, well, what am I to do with this? I mean, I feel called to use it in some way. And you saw that tension and started to act upon it in a way that I think is very powerful.
Well, and, you know, we were looking at this whole situation and thought, you know, there were about 10 or 12 universities that had started these clubs with apologists from various places when I came on board. And they were all tent makers, you know, doing other careers and running these chapters on university campuses. But there was so much interest that the folks, the students at SCS, they couldn't handle even the inquiries that were coming in. And, you know, we took it over in February, made it an independent corporation February 2nd, 2011. So Ratio Christi is a corporation, it's not even a year old. And since then, we have grown to over 60 chapters. We've probably got 30 or 40 more in the pipeline that we can't keep up with because it's just me and one other guy working on this right now while we try and build the revenue of this thing. And we believe that we're going to be on 500 universities around the world within the next 5 years. And we actually, in August, started bringing apologists on as in supported missionary positions, like Campus Crusade for Christ does with their campus ministers. And so we are the first organization broadly reaching out into the apologetics communities for those with significant apologetics training and bringing them on board in positions where they can actually earn a living doing apologetics at university campuses. And, of course, when they're doing that, we ask them to reach out to two or three churches and really, you know, try and promote apologetics training within the churches within the area that that university is in.
Okay, now this is a good point then, because some people are probably listening to this and saying, well, God, it kind of sounds like the early movements you see of other InterVarsity, other, you know, movements, Campus Crusade for Christ. So tell us exactly what it is that separates Ratio Christi from other organizations, what it is you are trying to do on the college campuses.
Yeah, when we first go on a campus, the first thing we ask our director to do is go meet with all the other campus ministry directors on campus and tell them that we are not there to steal students. We're not there to do anything but serve the entire campus community. In many cases, most cases, we get received pretty well. Sometimes, you know, they're pretty skeptical, another Christian group starting on campus, but we actually go in and offer to serve. Our directors offer to speak and do training at the other organizations. And then we start a small club. It's a university-sponsored club. In other words, we go through the process of becoming an official club of the university. And, of course, that gives us some access to the student government activity fee funding to do what we need to do, including weekly meetings with that small group of students who's interested in going deeper into studying apologetics and defending their faith. It allows us to do at least one and sometimes two events a year on campus with the SGA funding to bring in speakers like Greg Kokel, debates with William Lane Craig and somebody else. And we actually go out and engage directly with the other non-Christian groups on campus, like the Freethinkers, the Atheist groups, the Agnostics, Freethinkers. We have some universities that have pagan clubs, and of course a number of them have the Flying Spaghetti Monster people. So right. We actually go out and engage with them, and sometimes we'll even do co-sponsored events with some of the other non-Christian clubs to bring in some of those debates. So we focus entirely on apologetics and nothing else. We don't do what Navigators or Campus Crusade for Christ or Chi Alpha does, where you know, they have a worship service and a time of devotional Bible study, and they'll have bowling clubs and all, you know, where people can go out for fellowship. We encourage our students that are in Ratio Christi clubs to go out and be part of those organizations too, to get that Christian fellowship and to be able to join in the worship. But we focus entirely on how do we defend the truth that you know, of Christianity? And we, you know, we have our motto that says defending truth and Christianity at the university. And we've got to look at it that way, is that, you know, there's an attack on truth, so we're defending truth as well as the truth of Christianity.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because you are in the I don't know, for those of you who are listening to our show who don't yet subscribe to Solid Ground, you need to get over to str.org and subscribe. It's free. Greg sends out quarterly newsletters called Solid Ground. They're very robust, very well written. And he mentions in this most recent Solid Ground from this month, January, February 2012, he mentions in here the kind of three columns that Greg sees in apologetics, and that first column being those foundational, you know, apologists who set the stage for other organizations that might be considered in the second column. And now he sees what Greg describes. I won't give you the whole issue here. You would need to read it yourself. But he describes the third column and all the ministries that are growing in this generation, moving forward, the forward view of how apologetics will impact our culture and our church. And of course, he lists Ratio Christi as in that category, along with like Reasons to Believe and other organizations that have blossomed this very recently. And of all these organizations, it seems to me, Rick, that yours is the most recent. And it is so, I got to tell you, as somebody who gets a chance to speak at like UCI here locally or to speak at the local church setting, I find myself often frustrated that there isn't a sense of urgency and a real value in the importance of apologetics on the college in the college setting. And I just think that it's because we haven't had a consistent champion for apologetics at the university level. And you, it sounds like, are trying to be that champion, to be that force that moves in the university settings that tries to do all the things that Brett and I, for example, have always argued need to be done. We also take trips to Berkeley and trips to college campuses to show our young Christian high schoolers what to expect and what kinds of challenges they're going to be facing. But I don't see it being embraced nationwide, really, with the exception of your organization.
And it's a very exciting place to be in, where you know, we can actually focus on bringing apologetics and apologetics training to universities and to local communities. One of the really interesting things about this is the way we've designed this organization as a servant organization to serve other campus ministries, but not just that, to serve other apologetics ministries, to serve the seminaries, and to serve all folks interested and trained in apologetics around the country. We are working also with most of the other apologetics ministries. Just recently, I had a conversation with somebody from Ravi Zacharias Ministries, and the guy I was talking to said, you know, somebody there said, why didn't we think of that, you know?
Right.
Well, the fact is it's probably best that they didn't, because Ratio Christi, being an independent organization, we can serve Greg Kokel, and we're going to be launching something on our website that will be a speakers bureau, and we'll be able to list Greg and Brent and Alan and other apologists around the country with all the other ministries around the country, and we're setting up a coordinated apologetics calendar so that everything that all these people are doing will be there, and yet we're independent of them. If this were run, say, by Greg Kokel, you know, some of the other ministries would be just saying, oh, that's just Greg's way of blowing his own horn. I mean, he's just trying to build his own little kingdom there. But being independent, we can do this and serve everybody, and it's making this huge impact that God has just been multiplying way beyond our ability to even handle the growth that's going on right now. Chuck Colson has looked at this, and recently he had a meeting in his area in Virginia around the D.C. area, and I got invited to this meeting, and I couldn't believe the people that were invited to this. I mean, it was big-name ministries and people that run these various worldview organizations, and I went up to one of the VPs, and I said, we're 10 months old. How did we get invited to this? And the VP said, in all honesty, this meeting is about trying to develop a movement in worldview and apologetics ministries. And he said, you were one of the first ones invited because we couldn't find anything else that looked so much like a movement, like what you guys have going on.
Well, what I want to do is I want to take a break, because we're up against a hard break now, and I want to come back from that break and talk about the way that – a couple of things. Number one, I really want to know what you see as the big challenges that are on the campus that would motivate you to even start this. And number two, for those of us who are listening to this and maybe have already started to volunteer at our local church, have already started to step into some form of ministry in which we're making a case for what we believe, I want to talk to them a little bit about how they can get engaged in this process as well. So we'll do that right after the break. I'm Jay Warner Wallace sitting in talking to Rick Shanker from Ratio Christi, a great organization which is working hard on the college campus, and we'll be back right after this break.
Hi, Greg Kokel here, inviting you to a conference you won't soon forget. The location? The Eastern Caribbean. Join us as we set sail March 17, 2012, from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for 8 days aboard Holland America's MS Eurodam for an unforgettable trip to Grand Turks and Caicos Islands, San Juan, Puerto Rico, St. Thomas and the Virgin Islands, and Half Moon Cay in the Bahamas. I'll be joined by Stand to Reason Student Impact Director Brett Kunkel and STR speaker and trainer Alan Schliemann for a lineup of conference sessions that will stimulate your thinking and equip you with practical skills. Everything about this trip is being planned with your enjoyment and enrichment in mind. And this year we're planning some special youth sessions led by Brett, so plan on bringing the family and enjoying great times of fellowship and spiritual deepening together. Not only will you be challenged with stimulating presentations, you'll have a chance to ask questions in open forum discussions and enjoy the interaction and fellowship with both our speakers and your fellow passengers on deck, sharing great meals together and ashore as we enjoy the splendor of the Eastern Caribbean's beautiful resort ports. So save the dates and contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours. That's 800-247-1899. They're assisting Stand to Reason with their trip, and their skilled staff is committed to answering all your questions and helping to make this a memorable experience. You can also visit our website at str.org for all the information. I hope to see you there in the Caribbean with Stand to Reason.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? STR.org is a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for. Before you turn to Google, log on to STR.org, and you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse the range of topics, from our radio archives to advanced online training to our blog. You'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from STR.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ and the tactics that will help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. Your visit to STR.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you take a stand for the truth. So visit today. That's STR.org.
For a beautiful day here in Southern California. I'm not sure how beautiful it is in Pennsylvania right now, but I'm speaking with Rick Shanker from Ratio Christi, who's a leading organization that is doing heavy lifting in the university setting, establishing a movement, an apologetics movement. I do think that this is part of what Greg described in his article called The Third Column in this month's version of edition of Solid Ground. But I do think, Rick, you are starting a movement. You're at the forefront of it, and I think you don't even realize, maybe you do, of course, but most people don't realize the untapped resources of people who are preparing themselves to teach and to understand apologetics, to be engaged in this battle, that previously have had really a hard time finding a place to do it. Now you're going to give them a place. Am I right?
That's exactly right. In fact, our biggest need is more apologists. There are so many graduates of schools like Biola and Southern Evangelical Seminary, Luther Rice, Liberty, with good training in apologetics, and they're finding trouble using it because there's very few places that are hiring apologists at this point. We are looking for apologists that have other careers that want to use their apologetics as tent makers. We got a guy in Richard Stockton University who is a nurse and he sells pacemakers. Doesn't want to give up his day job, but he wants to run a Rush or Christie chapter there. We've got other folks out in California, UC Irvine, that are working, graduates of Biola, that are working at raising their support to become full-time missionaries on campus. And we want to provide those opportunities for them.
Okay, so that's the kind of thing I want to talk about the model for a second. Because let's just imagine that I am Jim Wallace, and I am living in, let's just say, Bakersfield, California. And I'm out there, and I listen to this program, and I'm like, wow, that sounds like something I could do. How do I get involved? What do I have to do to get involved in this?
Well, the first thing we ask folks to do is get onto our website at ratiochristi.org. It's ratio, R-A-T-I-O, and Christi spelled with an I, like Corpus Christi, and start to look around there. They'll come to a tab called Partners, and underneath there they'll find a link called Apologist Needed. If somebody just wants to help us get a chapter going, there's another link there called Adopt a College, where students or alumni of the university or leaders in churches can say, hey, let me adopt this college and help you get something going there. We need two things to start a Ratio Christi chapter on a university campus. Students, can't start a student club without students, so we need Christian students, but we also need an apologist. We will not let a club start without a trained apologist taking that campus under their wing and working with those students and developing that club. That helps stabilize the club. It helps to give the club somebody with good apologetics training, the students what they need, and it also helps make the club a long-term prospect because students come and go. They graduate at least after 4 years, and so our biggest need, apologists. If apologists want to get involved, and that's what I need more than anything. Now, maybe we need money too, but we really need apologists to go onto our site, look at those things, send us an email from the links that are listed on the site, and tell us they're interested. Tell us the university that they'd like to work in, and we'd love to. I listened to the show earlier. I heard callers from all over the country calling in. We are targeting the northeast part of the country, the six states in the northeast. If we got anybody up in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Maine, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Rhode Island, we are looking at a big program to go up there and get into some of the Ivy League schools. And we want somebody from that territory that knows the culture up there, and that can work with other ministries that we've started to develop a partnership with up there. But not just there, we want it all over the country. In fact, because of the internet, we can't stop this thing. We've got interest in the UK. We've got interest in Brazil. We got a chapter formed there. We got a big chapter in South Africa. We got one in India. In fact, we're talking to Ravi Zacharias Ministries about working with them to start expanding Ratio Christi chapters in India because of Ravi's connections. We've got interest in Australia, so this can be anywhere in the world.
Okay, but when you say you're looking for trained apologists, the question to my mind comes, well, then what is a trained apologist? I mean, I realize, of course, there are lots of programs out now that are apologetics programs, both at the master level. I mean, you've got them all over the country. There's some great ones right here in Southern California. So that's, of course, that would be the easiest thing to understand. If you've got a master's degree in apologetics, great. But what if you're somebody who feels very capable and maybe has some track record? What kind of track record are you looking for? What are you looking for if it's not? Is it only going to be people with master's degrees in apologetics?
Well, I would love to have everybody with a master's degree in apologetics contact me. But we realize that there's a lot of folks that are self-trained apologists. We got a guy in Springfield, Missouri, that's one of the best self-trained apologists I know, and he's going to lead a chapter. He doesn't even have his bachelor's degree, but he's a great apologist. And there may be other people that are just beginning their work in apologetics. And there's another link under our partnership tabs called Become an Apologist. And at the bottom of that link, there is something called List of Approved Training Programs. And so if we get somebody that will has got a handle on some of the basics and they'll start to go through more training, we may bring them on as an interim chapter director and let them work through the process of the training while they're working at starting a club.
Right. Okay. Very good. So it really comes down to it's most of us. I mean, there's certificate programs available at many of these colleges or universities as well, Christian universities that offer training in apologetics. And so what it comes down, I would imagine, you tell me if I'm wrong, Rick, depending on where you are in the country, if you're in a place where, you know, that this, and I would also imagine it's kind of a first come, first serve. If you've got somebody who's willing to step up in a place where no one is willing to step up, that's going to kind of give them some juice. Would you agree? Some momentum moving forward. And you might at that point be able to work with somebody, I would imagine, to help train them or help to get them ready. Am I right or wrong?
Yeah, that's it. But even if we have a chapter started, it's okay because we tell our chapter directors that once they get started, if a person starts at a university and all of a sudden we get another person interested or, somebody that's trained as a reasoned believe apologist, scientific apologetics, comes to us within that area and says, hey, I'm interested. Do you have anything going that I could help with? We want them to form teams with people that are trained in apologetics. We try and connect our folks with reasonable faith club directors and trying, encourage them to bring some of those folks on campus with them and work together. So it doesn't have to be new ground. It can be ground that exists and teams of apologists can work together.
Okay, that's now it's one thing to say that I've spent time, let's say I'm 45 and I've spent time, I'm interested in apologetics. I've even gone so far as to get a certificate degree somewhere in Christian apologetics, maybe a 13 or 14 unit program of some sort. And I believe I'm called to do this. I'm certainly interested in doing this. But it's one thing to say I feel called to make a case for what I believe. And it's another thing to say I'm willing to do that at the university setting. This is a very unique setting. And I want you to, just from what you've seen so far, what do you think are the chief challenges that are present at the university that are not maybe present in, working at your local church or in your local community in some way? What are the challenges that face us as apologists in that setting?
Well, the university is the hotbed of neo-atheism. It's being spread throughout the world and through this country, through the universities. And, this is the target of these folks. And, it's been there somewhat for a long time. I mean, it wasn't as toxic of a situation as it was today, where academics in the university would belittle Christianity and, they'd make arguments against it and humiliate students and, and then students would humiliate students for believing in God, the Bible, Jesus Christ. And, but the situation has become toxic in probably the past 5 years or so, especially with the advent of the neo-atheist and the four apocalyptic horsemen. Now I guess it's three apocalyptic horsemen, but the point is that, somebody that wants to do this needs prepared. We do an extensive interview of people to make sure they're prepared. If they're not prepared, we ask them to get more prepared. If they're still interested, if they're not prepared, then we look for somebody with a little bit more training to come together with them to form a club on campus. Because if you can do this out in a church, and it's fairly simple. I mean, most believers are going to say, oh, geez, I haven't heard this stuff before. This is great. They're not going to argue with you. But you get on campus and some neo-atheists show up to your chapter meeting and they've been reading all their stuff and they know their arguments, they can tear you apart if you're not prepared to deal with it.
Now, what are you asking that for then? And when you see these are particular unusual challenges that are unique to the university setting. If you had somebody who's listening to this show and is thinking, wow, I think I might be able to do that. Are there any particular characteristics, aside from, obviously a basis in apologetics, are there certain personality characteristics or kind of calling characteristics that you say you would think are needed in this particular university setting?
Well, personality characteristics are you can't be so shy you're afraid of people. But one of the things that we do talk about is the approach to apologetics. We really focus on a classical approach because, you know, at the university level, you're not going to deal with people, you know, from the point of view like, well, the Bible says this, and, you know, they're saying, man, don't make arguments with that. I don't believe in the Bible. You've got to be able to start where those folks are at. And we've had some folks that are, for instance, presuppositional apologists, and we've talked to them about this approach and had a number of folks, you know, make a determination that they could take this approach and that they could work on the university campuses with that. In a lot of ways, when we interview people, especially for positions where they have to raise their own funding and it's a paid position, we go through an actual assessment on some of their skills, how they rate themselves on, their ability to communicate, their ability to persevere through some of the things, how are they going to deal when the ad hominem attacks come and, you know, they're belittled and they need to answer with gentleness and respect. So, but for the most part, we're looking for people that are willing and able and articulate about their faith and know the arguments that we have some things that we take a stand on. There's other things that we're wide open with. For instance, the old earth, young earth issue. We say let the debate continue. We have a statement of belief on our website. People have to agree with that statement of belief. Those are basically the things that we go over with everybody that calls us.
Okay, Dave, you talked a little bit about the kind of things they might face, the challenges that you're seeing on the university setting, and I think that those are going to be important for people to keep in mind as they kind of jump into this. In some ways, I got to tell you, when leading young people into these kinds of settings, this is a high-tension setting for young Christians. You know, it's one thing to invite an atheist into your group. We've done that. We've done that quite a number of times. We've actually had lunches with local atheist groups, with our Christian groups, to see if we can kind of have a dialogue going back and forth. But when you say to your young team, we're now going to prepare for 8 weeks to get ready to go to Berkeley and spend time on the campus of Berkeley and with all the, you know, students in the different atheist groups in Berkeley in open dialogue or maybe in a panel discussion that's going to be well attended by both sides. You suddenly get to a place of high anxiety on the part of young Christians. And I wonder if you've seen that also true. Have you encountered any stories of people who felt they were prepared from the perspective of apologetics, but when they got into the setting of the university, found themselves a little more timid?
Actually, not so far. We try to screen people pretty well. And everybody that we've put into this setting, as far as what we call a chapter director, a leader, we've seen them do really well. Now, of course, there's the opposite situation. You get the students and you start to work with the students. You're right. They are not always prepared for what happens. I didn't even realize how bad it was. I had heard, about the attacks on Christians, humiliating students, ridiculing them, and I wasn't even sure, what form that took until I started to go to some of these meetings where we had debates or discussions and saw, how professors would stand up and, give this background information about some kind of data that they got, like polling data that proved that if you didn't believe in Darwinism, well, then you were probably just stupid.
Right.
Now, that's very intimidating for young people on campus when one of the main professors is calling you stupid in front of a room of 200 people. What do you do if you're the Chi Alpha organization or the Campus Crusade for Christ organization? The students go back to your meeting and they feel like, boy, this was not a very good situation. At least when there's a Ratio Christi chapter on campus, there's somebody to go to and a place to go or somebody to bring in to talk through some of those issues and why some of those attacks made no sense because they were just attacking the straw man or how somebody missed it in a debate and didn't have the evidence that they needed to overcome an objection. And, thus we build the faith of all these young Christians on campus.
Yeah, awesome. I want to come back after the break and talk a little bit about the reception you're getting from non-believers on the campus. There's also a strategy you have. I know you've talked a little bit on your website about making a comfortable setting for agnostics, for atheists. And you've even started to enlist the help of other professors and things on campus to start these kinds of movements on their local campus. I want to talk to you about all those things right after the break. So we'll do that. We'll come back here to Stand to Reason in a minute. We're talking, of course, to Rick Shanker from Ratio Christi. You can go to this website. It's www.ratiochristi. I'm going to spell it for you. RATIOCHRISTI.org. That was a lot and pretty fast, but if you're listening to the podcast, you can always rewind it and listen to it again. And we'll be back in 2 minutes here with Rick Shanker here on Stand to Reason.
We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material, too, by using the brand-new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org. or call 1-800-2-REASON.
Hi, this is Greg Kokel, and boy, am I excited to offer you my new book, Tactics. It's a book that I wrote to help you discuss your Christian convictions with non-Christians, and it outlines specific steps to follow that you can take that will help those conversations be less intimidating and more effective. And we've seen a tremendous response to this book, and many people have already told me how much it will help them, and I hope it will help you too. To get a copy for yourself or as a gift, simply visit tacticsbook.com. It's my aim to help you make a difference for the kingdom with this book. To order your copy, simply visit tacticsbook.com.
Sitting in for Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason, the show where we try to give you, try to look at life right side up. And that's what we're doing today with Rick Shanker from the president. He's the president of Ratio Christi. It's an organization. It's campus-based. It's a Christian apologetics organization. It's a movement. Don't even call it an organization, because I think that, Rick, if I'm right, you would rather see it for what it really is. And I think you see you're on the front side of a wave right now, aren't you?
Yeah, we really are. I mean, You know something is an organization only when, it's all my ideas and, we're going to run it this way. And this thing is way beyond me. It has taken off in ways that I could never have imagined or dreamed of. And, within 11 months, we've grown over 500%. We've got relationships with Greg Kokel and Ravi Zacharias Ministries and many other ministries. All the seminaries are working closely with us. In 11 months, that's all happened. I can't even imagine what it's going to look like in 5 years.
Yeah, interesting. I think that for me, and I was just talking to Melinda about this, the power of this is a couple of things. Number one, if you're somebody who is, well, it's amazing. I came to faith at 35, and I was already employed as a detective. I was already working in law enforcement. I was working undercover, as a matter of fact. I had really long hair, really big beard. I mean, I was looking like a bum. But I was intensely interested and giving my life to what I discovered was true. And if you think of that and you think, well, gosh, I want to be like uber Christian. I want to give it all. I started to look around and say, well, what do uber Christians look like? And the only models I really knew of at the time were pastors. You know, these are the guys who did this 24/7, whether they were paid or not. This is, they gave their lives to this cause. They gave their lives to this movement called Christianity. So what did I do? I entered seminary to become a pastor, and I ended up pastoring. This is what I thought you did if you were over the top and wanted to give your entire life to the cause of Christianity. And because there were pastoral positions out there in the marketplace, I thought, well, I'll train in seminary to take one of those spots. Had there been a movement, this is 15 years ago now, had there been a movement 15 years ago in which there were hundreds and thousands of positions available as an apologist, that is really where I'm in my shape. That's really, as a case maker, that's my shape. I'm sure I would have stepped off in that direction first. And what's interesting to me is it seems as you develop the end positions and make those available across the country, you're going to see this thing explode because people have been waiting for a place at the table, basically, or a place in the brigade, and wondering, what would I do with this degree? I'm interested in apologetics, but what do I do with a master's in apologetics? What do I do with that? You're basically answering that question for them, aren't you?
Well, and that's right. And that's why I told Craig Hazen when we developed our supported missionary program, I said, I want to double the number of students in your apologetics program.
That's exactly what's going to happen, I think. I think once you work on the end, the beginning starts to blow up, and I think that's exactly what you're seeking to do. Look, we only have a few minutes left in this hour to talk, and I wanted to just go through a couple of questions I've had in my mind related to your movement here. And I only imagine from my own experience on the college campus that there's always pushback in some area. So tell me, what has been your reception so far? I think most of the time, the opposite side in any argument, in any debate, in any movement, looks to see where the threat is. And when they discover where the threat is, that's where they pour their resources. Have the positions of atheists on the campus sensed that you're the threat yet?
No, and I think that's part of the arrogance of the academia. It's because, they really think they have the answers, and this is just a little flea that they can brush off. They actually like that somebody is there to engage in a discussion, a civil discussion on these issues. Now, depending on what group, like the free thinkers are really nice to deal with. They don't practice ad hominem attacks on people. They really talk to you and think through the issues. The NEL atheists are a little bit more caustic, taking the lead of people like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, and, they'll say, oh, you stupid Christians are always coming up with stuff, but they at least have somebody to engage now. The other campus ministries weren't doing that. Maybe they'd bring a debate on by William Lane Craig and, against some atheist, or they'd bring in Ravi and he'd lay out some logical cases for Christianity, but there was no way to engage in the discussions. Now, actually, they like us because they like to engage in the discussions, and the academics, that are the professors and the administration look at us like, hey, this is good, more critical thinking opportunities. So at this point, we are seen as something on campus that is a good thing. Now, will that continue? I don't know. If we get too big, they may say, hey, this is starting to hurt. And especially you start to get these biology departments that are, starting to, be hammered with ID and with, a lot of folks starting to question the real viability of neo-Darwinism. It might get nasty in the future. But right now, it's a great opportunity.
How have students, and not so much the faculty, how are the students there? You make a point on the website of wanting, it seems that this organization, this movement, is seeking to be attractive, not just to Christian kids who are on the campus and looking to defend themselves, but really to any seeker and investigator who's on the campus and may not even share our worldview. What are you actively doing? What kind of responses have you been getting from young students who are not believers?
We actually find that if we have an event, the best place to advertise is the various atheist clubs to talk about these events coming on campus, because they're the ones that are most interested in them. And, you know, so that's great. And then we get a lot of our clubs where, you know, various kids from the other groups, the free thinkers and the new atheists, et cetera, want to come to our meetings and listen and be involved in the discussion and debate and bring up some of their, you know, their arguments. But, you know, what we usually find, and I say this in one of my blogs, the arguments are the same from Oxford to Appalachia. They're just parroting stuff that's been written by Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or Daniel Dennett, and we know their arguments, and we teach our Christian students how to deal with them, and we work with them on their arguments to try and say, hey, you know, Christianity actually has a much better intellectual veracity than your worldview arguments. And we win some. A lot of them just want to hold on to their position because that fits their lifestyle, but they don't mind engaging.
Well, what have you had? Have you had any problems so far getting any of the Rosh Christi clubs recognized? Have you had any, like, organizational resistance?
Yes. At the university, there are some issues. There's a case going on down at San Diego State University right now. But we have the Alliance Defense Fund as our lawyers. They're very excited to work with us. One of their lawyers told me we've given them more business in a few months than they've got from other ministries in years. And we've taken a stand that we're not going to back down on our religious liberties at all. We're going to move forward in every case. And I think that's why they like us so much, ADF does. And we've gotten our constitution approved so far at every university where we've presented it. Sometimes with minor modifications, but nothing that would jeopardize the integrity of our group.
Now, okay, so looking at that then, it appears that you're having an experience there that where most of the resistance is coming not even from professors, because they love the fact that, and I suspect, and you tell me if I'm wrong, Rick, do they love the fact that you're available for the discussion because they believe up front that they're going to give you a licking? You know, basically, if you want to, they love the fact that you would be available for a beating, basically. Is that what it comes down to from their perspective?
I would say that that's the pretty arrogant attitude among most of the academics.
But the students, on the other hand, are much more – it seems like it's really the organization of the university where you're getting the most resistance. Am I right?
Yeah. The administration of the university, especially when it comes to constitutional issues and how those are being interpreted by the courts, and will they allow Christian clubs to participate and gain access to SGA activity fees, and are we allowed to elect officers that we say have to be adhere to our tenets of beliefs? Those are the big issues
okay.
Right now going on in the courts. But again, we have ADF backing us up, and we won't back down in any case.
Awesome. Now let me just ask a kind of a personal question. You, can I ask you how old you are?
I'm 54.
Okay, so I'm 50, and one of the things that's been a challenge we're not that old. We're young. We're very young. We are extremely young. But the point is, I think we are of a different generation, and this generation is really actively engaged. I've got kids that are ranged from 14 to 23, and I'm curious, how have you been kind of mobilizing social media with this generation to make this movement a reality on the campuses?
That is probably one of the best parts of Rosh Christi for the chapters, is that every time we set up a new chapter, they immediately get their own page on our page, their own website address on our page. They get a blog on our page. They get a calendar on our page and several other features. Then we set them up with a Rosh Christi Facebook page that's designated for their chapter with their chapter name in it. We give them a Twitter account, Rosh Christi Twitter account with the university's name in it, Rosh Christi UC Irvine, let's say. And we work with them to use those tools. We use those tools, and we're creating a huge amount of Christian blogging and activity going on the Internet, all under the name Rosh Christi. So it's starting to get a huge amount of hits, and in a short period of time, you know, how long have we had the website this way? Probably 7 months now. We move up on a lot of searches, very near, if not on the front page, very near the front page.
You know, what's interesting is I'm looking at the Ratio Christi Facebook page, and it's over 60 of the people who are related to our fan page on Facebook, for Please Convince Me. Over 60 are also, like and have posted themselves on your webpage as well. So I see the kind of interconnectedness of this. Do you have anybody who's helping you kind of strategize with that, or how are you – is this kind of a more organic process of letting your chapters kind of think ahead of you and see how it works kind of university to university?
Well, it's actually both. We do have an IT team in place. We've got a guy that we've hired as a IT consultant that builds our website. And then our director of administration, Blake Anderson, who is also an apologist, by the way, is very IT savvy and very social media savvy. And he's been working at building this. But I got to tell you, a lot of that has just come because the interest is out there. We haven't had time because we don't even have time to handle all the inquiries that we get in sometimes. It takes 2-3 weeks just to get back to somebody that sends an email saying, hey, I'm interested in knowing more. We haven't even had time to build and promote our Facebook site, and you know already we're over at 800 people. I think once we start to promote that, we're going to be in the thousands and tens of thousands.
Well, that's good to know, because people are going to actually probably, as a result of this interview, I hope they'll be contacting you. And it's good to know that, hey, it may take a little while to get back, but I can assure you that this is worth your wait. And I want to thank you, Rick Schenker from Ratio Christi, for joining us today. A great organization, great movement that I am just delighted to see that it's established, and I can't wait to see what it has in store. So thanks for joining us today, Rick.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, well, that's it, folks, today for this edition of the Stand to Reason radio program. And I'm so grateful to Greg and Melinda and Barbara for having me back again today. This is another week we have that God has given us to go out and make a case, to make two decisions. This first decision to trust Christ for our salvation should be followed by another decision to make a case for what Christ has done for us and the truth of the Christian worldview. So go out this week, as Greg would say, and give him heaven. And until next week, Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts and radio program are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.